listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the October 17th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. The last time I spoke on Takes on the World about the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, it was April 11th, and he had just completed a triumphal tour of the United States and appeared on the cover of Time. The magazine's lengthy feature article showed bin Salman, out of his traditional Saudi garb and dressed in Western clothing, meeting in all smiles with Michael Bloomberg, Jeff Bezos, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Richard Branson, James Madison, Christian Lagarde, head of the World Bank, although for the last two he wore his usual Saudi robe and keffiyeh headscarf. He also met with Oprah, but fortunately for her, a photo of that meeting included. "Never has American hypocrisy been so shamelessly displayed," I said at the time, and the reader had to go well into the article before arriving at the war in Yemen. In the name of standing up to Iran, Times' Carl Vick had written, bin Salman launched a 2015 air war in Yemen that has cost more than 10,000 lives and devastated what was already the poorest country in the Arab world. Of the 16,749 bombing runs, he wrote, recorded since 2015 by the Yemen Data Project, independent human rights monitoring group, nearly a third targeted non-military sites. The UN calls it the worst man-made humanitarian disaster of our time. Well, now it appears that outside the White House and the State Department, bin Salman may be the man no one dares to touch, since he has been accused of ordering the disappearance or, more likely, killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd. I find it curious, but not surprising, and perhaps you do as well, at the probable murder of a single Saudi journalist in Turkey, a writer for the Washington Post and well-known in the Beltway's political and social circles, has raised a storm of criticism and questions in the U.S. Congress about Mohammed bin Salman and the killing of thousands of Yemeni civilians under his orders failed to do. That's one of the things I hope to be speaking about at 20 minutes past the hour with award-winning investigative journalist Gareth Porter. We'll be discussing the latest moves by the Trump administration against Iran, while at the same time is challenging traditional U.S. military adventurism elsewhere. The title of Porter's recent article on antiwar.com and several other websites poses the question, could Trump take down the American empire? More than any other presidency in modern history, he writes, Donald Trump has been a veritable socio-political wrecking ball, deliberately stoking conflict by playing to xenophobic and racist currents in American society and debasing its political discourse. That fact has been widely discussed, Porter notes. But Trump's attacks on the system of the global U.S. military presence and commitments have gotten far less notice. He has complained bitterly both in public and in private meetings with aides about the suite of permanent wars that the Pentagon has been fighting for many years across the greater Middle East and in Africa, as well as about deployments and commitments to South Korea and NATO. This, according to Porter, has resulted in an unprecedented struggle between a sitting president and the national security state over a global U.S. military empire that has been sacrosanct in American politics since early in the Cold War. He goes on to cite Bob Woodward's recent book, Fear, Trump and the White House, as providing dramatic new details about that struggle. There has been considerable news about the Khashoggi case and the likely involvement of bin Salman, which you will get elsewhere, but nobody seems to have mentioned that instead of speaking directly with bin Salman himself, with whom he and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have had what these days is described as a bromance, Trump called the ancient King Salman, who had suspended all activity at the end of August on the advice of his medical team. Since the crown prince has essentially taken over the country, that the old king would be informed of what his nephew was planning for Khashoggi is unlikely. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, whose first official act upon being appointed as CIA chief was to travel to Saudi Arabia and express his support for the regime, was back there yesterday ostensibly to confront officials about the disappearance of Khashoggi. But the visit wasn't so much contention as it was downright chummy, observed the Huffington Post Ryan Grenoble. Video of the interaction provided by the Saudi own channel Al Arabiya, shows Pompeo smiling warmly and laughing for the cameras. Trump quickly followed up on Twitter with a suggestion that the Crown Prince was leading, quote, a full and complete investigation into the alleged torture, death, and dismemberment of the Saudi journalist. As I assume most of you were, to learn about a major investment conference that is to be hosted by the Crown Prince, unofficially labeled the Davos of the Desert, that will be held before the end of the month. Not in the desert, of course, but in the ultra-fancy Ritz-Carlton Hotel, where Ben Salman imprisoned a number of the wealthiest members of the kingdom some months back in what he claimed was an effort to root out corruption, or more cynically, one might say, competition. The disappearance or death of Khashoggi has caused most of those planning to participate to pull out, including a number of media sponsors, among them the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, CNBC, the Financial Times, Bloomberg, CNN, and The Economist. The only one not to do so thus far has been Fox Business Network. Why any media outlet would be associated with such an endeavor, there have been no explanations offered, particularly when hosted by a country which launched and continues to wage a war on its neighbor Yemen, creating what has been described by international organizations, as I mentioned, as the world's worst human catastrophe on the planet. You are not likely to read or hear about it in the U.S. press, but some important Israelis are very troubled by the allegations against the Saudis. This stems not from any concern for Khashoggi, but because outside the United Arab Emirates, the kingdom has been its closest ally in pushing against the nuclear deal and for the harshest U.S. sanctions, if not outright war on Iran. The Jerusalem Post, Haaretz, and the Israeli media, however, do not operate under the same restrictions as our free press. Today's Haaretz carried the headline, quote, "Why the Khashoggi murder is a disaster for Israel." And yesterday, the Post quoted Aaron Lerman, vice president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies and a former deputy national security council head, as saying, quote, "It's certainly not in our interest to see the status of the Saudi government diminished in Washington," end quote. Dory Gold, the head of Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs and a former foreign ministry director general, agreed, saying, quote, "This problem would be used by the Iranians to drive a wedge between the West and Saudi Arabia." "This is bad for Israel," he added, "because anything that strengthens Iran's posture in the Middle East is bad for Israel. And in the Mideast balance of power, a weakened Saudi Arabia means a strengthened Iran. It also means a strengthened Turkey," he said, "which could explain why Ankara is going all out on this issue, releasing surveillance tape and leaking information about the investigation." "Turkey is part of an axis with Qatar," said Gold, "and that puts Saudi Arabia at odds with the Turkish government." "There's another theme in their relations as well," he said, "and that is that the Saudi Arabia looks around the Middle East and sees hegemonic powers that threaten its vital security interests," he said. "The most obvious is Iran, but Turkey is another hegemonic power that could put Saudi interest at risk." That's Dory Gold from the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Well, Walter Russell Mead is a professor of foreign affairs and humanities at New York Bard College and arguably the leading apologist for Islamia, who doesn't happen to be Jewish. When a response from a respected non-Jewish professor is required, such as when Professors John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt wrote a groundbreaking book linking the Israel lobby to take the war on Iraq, he was their man. "This appears to be the case where Israel's interests would be threatened by a U.S. break with the Saudis, as I noticed a moment ago." So to their aid comes Professor Mead. In his regular column in the Wall Street Journal, Mead notes that while, quote, "the murder of Jamal Khashoggi was a horror, the Muslim Brotherhood, Turkey's President Erdogan, and the Ayatollahs of Iran are huddled over the corpse, hoping to turn a political profit from the death of an innocent man." After Mr. Khashoggi's death, he wrote, "even the most naive observer can see that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is at best a modernizing autocrat using dictatorial power to drag his country into the future. Saudi Arabia is not," he admits, "an authoritarian caterpillar metamorphosizing into a liberal butterfly. But neither are Turkey and Iran," he says. "And on crucial issues, U.S. and Saudi interests are aligned. To do what the Iran deal chorus and the Erdogan and Muslim Brotherhood apologists want," writes Mead, "to dissolve the U.S.-Saudi alliance in a frenzy of righteousness would be an absurd overreaction that plays into the hands of America's enemies," end quote. In other words, writes Walter Russell Mead of Bard College, the last thing America should be caught doing is holding a modernizing autocrat like Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who happens to be our and Israel's ally, accountable for murder, or no doubt for the 48 beheadings that have already taken place this year in Saudi Arabia. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency reports that, quote, casino mogul and Jewish mega-donor Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam have poured at least $25 million more into the Republican super PACs to ensure Republican control of the House and Senate after the midterm elections. The donations reported late last week, first by Politico, notes the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, in addition to at least $55 million to the GOP in the last few months, mostly to the Congressional Leadership Fund, a super PAC allied with House Speaker Paul Ryan, and the Senate Leadership Fund, which has been close ties to Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader. The new gifts could put Adelson's donations for this federal election cycle close to $100 million, the New York Times reported, citing what it called people with knowledge of the couple's plans. That amount is, quote, a staggering sum for one family to give in any election year, but especially one without a presidential race, end quote, says the Times. Indeed it is. One could make the argument that the Adelson's contributions, she is an Israeli, constitute foreign influence in our upcoming election and Trump's most outlandish accusation made against the Russians for 2016. That he owns Israel Hayam, the most widely read paper in Israel, that he publicly apologized to an Israeli audience in 2010 for having served in the U.S. Army instead of the Israel Defense Force. You can still see it for yourself on YouTube, in which he expresses the hope that his son will become a sniper in the Israeli Defense Forces. And that his one criteria for supporting U.S. politicians, which he openly admits, is their position on Israel, should disqualify him from having anything to do with our elections, but we know the Democrats, themselves dependent on wealthy Jews for major donations, such as Haim Saban, Michael Bloomberg, and George Soros, and no doubt fearful of provoking anti-Semitic backlash, are not about to say a single word. That's just the way it is. The domestic war on the American public seems bound to intensify if Sheldon Adelson's millions are effective and the Republicans continue to control both houses of Congress after next month's midterm election. After instituting a $1.5 trillion tax cut and signing off on a $675 billion budget for the Department of Defense, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said yesterday that the only way to lower the record-high federal deficit would be to cut entitlement programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. It's disappointing, but it's not a Republican problem, McConnell said of the deficit, which grew 17% to $779 billion in fiscal year 2018. McConnell told Bloomberg News, it's a bipartisan problem. Unwillingness to address the real drivers of the debt by doing anything to adjust those programs to the demographics of America in the future. The deficit has increased 77% since McConnell became majority leader in 2015. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Israel has passed a controversial new nation-state law. This sparking both celebration and fierce debate over the very nature of Israel itself. The law does three big things. One, it states that the rights to exercise national self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people. Two, it establishes Hebrew as Israel's official language and downgrades Arabic, a language widely spoken by Arab Israelis, to a, quote, special status. Three, it establishes Jewish settlements as a national value and mandates that the state will labor to encourage and promote its establishment and development. To the 20% of the Israeli population who are Palestinian, it further solidifies that Israel is truly an apartheid state. This week we feature a Palestinian pushback. Jafar Farah, director of the Masawa Center, which monitors and promotes Arabic rights in Israel, and clinical psychologist Nabila Espanioli, a feminist activist who founded the Al-Tafula Women's Center in Nazareth, addressed the new apartheid law at the Harvard Law School, and This Week in Palestine was there to record it. Here is their response to a law that negates the very existence of the Palestinian people.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.
You know, I don't want to say that I'm happy to see only friends that I didn't see for 20 years, but I would like to thank everybody. So everybody knows you, huh? But also to thank Nadine and the friends of Mada and everybody that was involved in organizing this meeting. We are here for the last 2 weeks, so we are a little bit exhausted from going around and speaking about the situation and the reality of the Palestinian community in Israel, but I think in every meeting we get new thoughts and new ways to act, and we are actually, you know, we are an action organization, action-oriented. We are not a think tank, and we need always to find ways to change the reality and challenge the reality that we face. So for the last 2 weeks, we were here to advocate for the rights of the Palestinian Arab community in Israel, which is, in the bigger context, is the context of also the Palestinian tragedy and the Palestinian crisis in general. We, Palestinians in the state of Israel, we are part of the Palestinian people, of course, and we are part of the struggle to end the occupation and to end the Palestinian tragedy, which also include, of course, being one of the nations that still suffer from refugees and living as refugees. So for the first week, we have been in, around the UN and in New York. It wasn't happy, especially the part to see how the Arabs are fighting each other in front of the UN, so the Qatarians against the Saudis. But at least we came as fresh and good news in this sense, because we, the Palestinian community inside Israel, we are not planning to run for any presidency. We can't. So. But actually, the good news that we are, and at least in the Palestinian community in Israel, we are the only Palestinians for the last 20 years, 15 years at least, that can elect, and we have political leadership that have been elected. This is the only Palestinian group that have the chance to elect political leaders. And we just came from Brussels a month ago, meetings with Mogherini and with the leadership of 28 member states. And we have been in Washington, D.C. to try to see, you know, your elected leaders, how they think and what they think that can do. You are not happy. So we share frustration. No. Actually, the feeling was in D.C. that there is some good atmosphere. I hope that we can share this good atmosphere. You know, 40 members of the Congress that dare to sign a call to end this tragedy of children in detention. 100 members of Congress that are were brave to sign also a call to give the money, the allocation to UNRWA. So in this sense, and you know, we have a soon election, and still people were brave to sign calls that support human rights, and this is something that we don't see it usually. So in this sense, there is good feeling around, and we are here to call you, go ahead. You know, usually Jewish Americans, especially from the left, they like to come and to call us, go and vote. In every election, we have like many Jewish Americans with money that they come and tell us, go and vote as a Palestinian inside Israel. So this time we decide to come here and to call the Arab Americans. Which file or to whom they should vote?
We have some good people to vote for now.
Yes, it depends on what in any case, during our meetings in Washington, and we need your help here also, we met with members of Congress and senators and staffers, almost 30 people, good people. I think the bad ones didn't want to meet with us. But the main issue that we were talking about was the Jewish Nation State Law, the new law that have been approved in the Knesset. This is the main issue that we raised. And actually, we were happy to see also that more and more Jewish American organizations were really brave finally to talk about the fact that Israel is going, if it's not already today, is going to apartheid regime, not only in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, but also inside the Green Line. And we will not be happy if this apartheid regime will be able to work for long term. You know, already 50 years of occupation, and we don't think that we should get used to the fact that the Palestinian community in Israel will suffer from systematic discrimination, not only through 35 laws. So it's already we have 35 laws. They didn't really need this basic law, but they were looking for ways actually to kill our dream, in the way that Martin Luther King was talking about the dream, to kill the dream of the Palestinian community to become equals once. Okay? So this is the purpose, because when it comes to the law, and I don't know how much, do you know what I'm talking about? If you don't know, there's copies of the law behind, we can distribute it if somebody can take the law and our paper also again about the law, so you can know what we talk about. The law is very simple law. It says Israel is the Jewish state actually, but beyond that, Israel is the land of Israel, is the historical land of Israel. So we don't talk actually about the Green Line. So just to put you in the picture, okay, the land, Article 1, the land of Israel is the historical homeland of the Jewish people. We are not there as a Palestinian minority, but as a Palestinians in general. The state of Israel, of course, have to exercise national self-determination. The state of Israel is unique only for the Jewish people, actually. Of course, when it comes to the symbols of the state, is, you know, don't take into consideration the fact that we are there. The capital of the state is Jerusalem, complete. Okay, so we don't need Obama. It's clear that the Jerusalem is complete and the capital of the state united. The language, you know, already today, the Arabic language is not, it's official language. It's one of the two official languages of the state of Israel. But if you go practically to the Knesset, for example, where they create laws, there is no translation, simultaneous translation of the debates, there is no simultaneous translation of the laws are not translated. So in practically, the Arabic language has been weak all over the years, since 70 years, I think. In the last 50 years, it was worse, the situation was worse. I think in the first 20 years, there was much more will to translate decisions, government decisions, even laws, but in the last 30, 40 years, there is almost no translation of legislation. But, this is not a law that we are, the downgrade of the Arabic language will have an impact much more on the Jewish community than on us. You know, if you take Nabila, for example, Nabila, the main thing that she did in the last 20 years was women issues, but also children literature. So since we have been isolated inside the Green Line, inside the Antel 67, we didn't have access to children literature. But I will leave this part to Nabila to talk about it. I will talk about TV and TV productions. You know, if I was raised as a children to go to and to bring the Yedioth Ahronot newspaper to even my father to read the news, or my father to read the newspaper, and there was one or two channels, today there is 1,000 channels in Israel. But there wasn't any channel that produced content from the Palestinian community inside Israel. So actually you went to the TVs and you have satellites, you have every small group in the Middle East that have channels, but we can't have channel, TV channel. So in 2015, finally, I took off from Musawa and we started to establish the first independent Arab TV station. But today, if my kids want to see programs in TV, so they don't have to see anymore. So there is any more Israeli TVs. So actually, there is disengagement from the Arab community. The Arab community, you know, like the second point, I went to the regular, to the Knesset and to the Channel 2, to the whole council, and I told them, you know, if you don't want to produce Arabic content in the public channels in Israel, so it will be the last meeting that we will hold. It was in 2005, we went to the Supreme Court and we said there is no Arabic content that is produced in the public channels in Israel. So they told us something like, okay, you know, it's not important, it will, you know, the Arab community, 20% of the population, are not important to be seen in the Israeli TVs. So we want to establish TV stations. So we have today at least two Arabic TV stations that are producing content. One is funded by the Palestinian Authority and one is funded by the Arab private sector. But you can't get public funding to produce. But you know, this, the impact of this law will be on the Jewish community itself. The Jewish community itself have to decide they want to live in the Middle East, which is the Arabic language, is part of the language of this region, or they want to keep isolating themselves. You know what? I don't care if the Secret Service will have less qualified people that will look after us. So I don't think that we will be the ones, you know, like there was many debate, many talks about the downgrade of the Arabic language. I think the strength of the Arabic language is our responsibility. I don't trust the State of Israel to take care that Israel will become, for example, a multilingualistic country. If you compare the status of the Arabic language with the Russian language, for example, language of 1 million immigrants, you can understand that there they have not only regulations but also practices that Russian is actually very strong and more strong than Arabic language in many private and public institutions. So one of the laws that, you know, try to affect actually achievements of the civil rights movement in Israel was the law to enable Israel to make segregation in housing. Now that's not new news. That's not news at all. But since the establishment of the State of Israel, the kibbutzim, which everybody knows here, are not willing to accept Arabs. They vote for the left, they vote for Meretz and the Labour Party, but still there is no members of the kibbutzim that are members of the kibbutzim.
Used to vote.
Yeah, okay, they used to vote. But in any case, since the establishment of the State of Israel until today, there is more than 600 Jewish settlements that have been built inside the Green Line. All of them are places for the Jewish population. So when Adala or Acri or any human rights organization went to the Supreme Court in the past, we were willing to convince the Supreme Court to make the balance between Jewish state and democracy, Jewish state and services. For example, when our human rights organizations went to the court with the issue of language, the court said in the balance between the Jewish state and service, not identity, service, who will give service? So we will order the cities of Haifa and the cities of Yaffa and Tel Aviv to add Arabic to the street signs. So it's not identity issue. Okay? And the whole debate, it took years of a debate in the Supreme Court. The whole debate about the identity issue and the right issue. Do we have the right to practice our linguistic rights? It was assigned, and in the end it became much more service Supreme Court decision than identity and principle issue related to our right to practice our language and our identity in the public space. The same happened with us when we went to the Supreme Court with the culture rights. Less than 5% of the allocation that the Minister of Culture allocate to Arab organizations, to Arab cultural institutions and productions, goes to productions in Arabic. Less than 5%. So in the end, we went to the court, and the court said something like, you know what? You know, this is like public money. What do you want us to decide who deserves to get money for cinema productions or theater or etc.? So in this sense, the Supreme Court was very sensitive when it came to take decisions if Israel is a Jewish state or not. And the Supreme Court went, you know, even in family unification, there is a temporary law that was approved in 2003. Since then, they extend this law almost every year. And when we went as human rights organizations to the court and said, look guys, you know, it's family unification. People that are citizens of the state of Israel fall in love, mistake. Okay, they fall in love with Palestinians from the occupied territories. They want to live together. Give them the right to have family unification process. It's not an immediate one. So the court said, no, there is security reasons. Today with this law, there is no need for security reasons. And the changes in the Supreme Court, the whole discussion that is taking place now in the U.S. about the nomination of Supreme Court judges, is, you know, it had not been done in Israel. The settlers' organizations in Israel took over the Supreme Court. You know, it's not the right wing or the center right. It's the right wing settlers, representatives, Ayelet Shaked, that is leading the process of nominating judges that affiliated with totally the right wing, not only right wing, but even settlers, to be part of the Supreme Court. And the segregation and housing that is part of this law, our friends in one of the human rights organizations, I think it was ACRI, went to the Supreme Court and said, you know, A'dan family want to be members of a new settlement, Harish. The Supreme Court, after years of discussion, they said, you can't prevent them from doing that. It was an achievement of the civil rights movement. So now, it's possible to do it. And if we will go back to that Supreme Court, probably the Supreme Court will say, no. There is a basic law that says clearly that you have to encourage Jewish settlements and you have to encourage and to give the... You know, it's not only about encouragement of segregation inside Israel. I have to pay to subsidize Jewish Americans. According to this law, we, the Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, we should pay taxes not only to implement the occupation in the occupied territories, but also to subsidize Jewish Americans if they need any help. Today, we subsidize them without help. You know, there is ministry. No, people think that only Jewish Americans send money. The Israeli government is investing in Aliyah, is investing in these whole programs to bring Jews and to protect Jews and etc. You know, maybe I can understand it when it comes to Ethiopia. I can't understand it why, you know, the Israeli government have to convince Jews in the U.S. not to marry non-Jews, for example. Something that I think there was a big issue about it. I think the NIF was very active on that. But there was, for a while, a campaign to prevent mixed marriages between Jewish American, Jews abroad and non-Jews. Imagine. You know, the right, you know, actually this law is very, you know, like you make a law, the first thing that you know you make in any legislation, you say, you know, what you mean, you know, what you mean with the Jewish people? What you mean? It's the Reform Jewish movement, the ultra-Orthodox, who's Jew? This is a question that haven't been identified in Israel. It's not clear today in Israel. You know why in Israel there is no equality? Not because of us. Because of women's status, homo lesbian communities. You know, we were sitting in 2006 in the debate in the Justice Committee to talk about constitution. And the ultra-Orthodox parties were sitting in the, you know, we were sitting behind. Yeah, the debate is not with us in any case. And the ultra-Orthodox parties told the women organizations, the homo-lesbian organizations, the Reformed Jewish organizations. If you think that there will be equality in the constitution, there will be no constitution. And we don't have constitution. But we don't have equality also in any basic law in Israel. There's no equality. So this is the reality. This is the reality that has been for 70 years. The reality of occupation, the reality that, you know, the Israeli government today is telling the international community, we really don't care what you say and what you do. So we are here to tell you, we want to see that you do care. Okay? In this sense, we met with many people. We prevent meeting with the administration. We didn't thought that there is anything useful in the administration these days. So we went to meet with politicians. The first round was to convince the Democratic Party. You know why? Because like 10 years ago, everybody celebrated the chosen guy, Obama, that I think most of you voted for him. And we hope, you know, we had like huge expectations that Mr. Obama will not sacrifice the rights of the Palestinian minority in Israel in his power. But, you know, a few weeks after the election, we met with the National Security Council team with a draft of the strategy paper of the White House. And we were reading there, Jewish state and rights for all its citizens and a Palestinian state. We told the guys, you know, Habibi, you know, African-American, you say Jewish rights, Jewish, you know, collective rights. You know, it's like African-American rights. And then you say rights for all its citizens, what? We are rights? Why there is no collective rights of the Palestinian minority if you are going to two-state solution? So in the end, like the gentlemen, they were in the door out, and you know, you can sit here and join us. Thank you. But they told me something like, maybe you don't like it, but you will never get better than this. We didn't get better than this. The Palestinians didn't get better than this. And, you know, a few weeks before, no, it was actually half a year before the election. Here, we met with Samantha Power. She was the American ambassador of the UN in Jerusalem. And I was very angry. I told her something like, you missed the whole 8 years. You didn't do anything, not for peace, not for minority rights. She's not. She came also from, I think she's here. I think she's teaching here. So I was very angry. I think she still remembers this conversation. Mm-hmm. We were five people. She still remembers this conversation. I told her, frankly, that the Democratic Party actually didn't understand the historical moment that they had. And today, we have midterm election, and in 2 years, hopefully, you will do better than the last election. And we will get a new administration, and we have to ensure that minority rights will not be sacrificed. So if you vote in the election, and you have senators and members of the Congress, on behalf of the Palestinians in general, and on behalf of the Palestinian community in Israel, we need you to ensure that nobody will sacrifice our rights as a minority that nobody hear about. You know, we don't have embassies to talk on our behalf. The maximum that we can get is people, committed people like the guys that organized this event, to open doors for us and to tell you the truth. The truth that we want to live with the Jews. Don't tell anyone. We don't want to throw them to the We, the Palestinians in Israel, in a few weeks, in a few, you know, like in the next half a year, we would find ourselves in confrontation with the state authorities. Because this is what they are designing. Law to implement home demolition, the cabinet's law was approved a year ago. This law, hostility in the streets, you know, atmosphere that you don't know how it will end. I went to pick up my kids from demonstration in Haifa on May 18. I ended, you know, some people know me in Israel. I ended in the jail with my children with a broken knee. Beaten by police in the police station. And then everybody in Israel giving different stories of how my leg was broken. It was a big joke. Not for me. But like people were telling, you know, like, what's going on here? You arrest a human rights defender, you beat him, you attack him inside the police station, You have documentation of all of the process until he was taken in a police car. My children was beaten, and he was 21 people were attacked in the police station. This is a country that is going to fascism. Okay? And we have to protect ourselves. This country is going to demolish tens of houses in the near future, not only in Khan al-Ahmar, but also inside the Green Wall. And we will need to protect ourselves, and we may find ourselves in a reality like October 2000. And we are here to alert also the Republicans. We don't want to sacrifice ourselves. We don't want to be victims of home demolition. We don't want to be victims of human rights violation. Help us to prevent that in between now and the Israeli election. Because the last election wasn't about anything serious. Was even between some elections in Israel in the last 20 years were between Sheldon Adelson and Yisrael Hayom and Moses' family and Yedioth Ahronot. Imagine. It wasn't about the occupation. I think this law will give us the opportunity for first time to go for the election in Israel on principle issues. Do the Jewish Israelis want to live in a state of occupation, discrimination? Okay? Or they want to live in a state that will end the occupation and build peace, will end the discrimination and will build solidarity between communities. Equality, it will be part of its future, and democracy will be part of its vision. These are the issues that I think we as Palestinians inside Israel are able to go to the next election and put it on the table of the Jewish public in Israel. Where do you want to go? This ongoing status quo. They legislate, they occupy, they surround Gaza, they build walls, and it's going on. It has to be dealt with. And I think everybody here, from the Jewish Americans to African Americans and Latin Americans, have to take responsibility. I was happy. I was in Virginia, and we met there in a reception with a group, and I was happy to listen to senators and members of Congress, that they were proud that they had been in Dallas Airport when these flights came, and they were, making this whole demonstrations in front of these airports against this whole Obama decision to prevent refugees and to prevent people, to ban people from certain countries to come.
Trump.
I start to mix between. It's not politically correct, I know. But in any case, they were proud. You know, we have racial profiling in Israel. We have, weekly, every day racial profiling. And it's about time that Israel will decide, Israel didn't have worse than September 11th. But Israel have to decide the humiliation of people in Israeli airports, it's political decision, it's not security. The security situation here was much worse than the security situation that was in the Israeli airports. So it's a political decision with the equipment that exists today. They don't need racial profiling, but they do it to humiliate us, and they did this law to humiliate us and to kill the dream to be equals. So, thanks for coming. I think Nabila will do better job than my job. And in any case, we are looking for the opportunity to talk to you and think with you, because after this visit, we are going to Chicago tomorrow, and then to Los Angeles, and then to San Francisco, and we need your networks. We are building a database, we are building a networks, and we want to talk to people. We want to talk to people that you elect, and we want them to hear our voices. So help us to do this. Tell us how to do the best job, and help us to do it with African Americans, Jewish Americans, Arab Americans, Latin Americans, everybody that care about human rights. And I think there is a lot of people. I don't know why it's not translated usually in the election. I hope that you will do better than us when it comes to the midterm election. In any case, we had huge expectations from the results of the midterm elections, and we hope that you will be able to do better job than the one that we did in the last election. Thank you.
This law came not by chance. It is exact process that we've been struggling against inside Israel. We have in the last, since 1948 actually, we were a community which is was the infrastructure of all the Palestinian community inside Israel was destroyed in 1948. And we were under military rule until 66. And and we began, we survived the Nakba, the disaster of the Palestinian, Palestinian history. We developed our infrastructure, we developed our organization, and we developed our work within the State of Israel. And we have a, today, we have a powerful, organized community united in the political platform in terms of we had the United List that have 13 seats in the parliament. We are the third power inside the parliament. So we are a big community and organized and powerful community. We moved from being marginalized community to a community that is empowered, that is organized, and that has a lot of problems internally, but we are struggling against them. Jaffer was telling you about this law and the elements of the law. I think that the law has the impact not only in our life, in our daily life, it has an impact about the whole future of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because when you say that the principles, three principles in the first, and it is a basic law. In Israel, there is no constitution. Basic law are actually influencing all other laws. So if we have even some laws that don't mention the Jewish state, now we have a law that can be interpreting all other laws in that sense. And in fact, we have already some cases in the court that are using the law before the state developed the meaning of that law. One of the court decision lately was using this law to give more compensation to a Jewish injured person because he is a Jew. And this is in the court. This is happening today before the setup of the law, what it will mean. And so we can expect in all fields the implementation will be very bad. So what we're doing? In the past, this law actually set the line for what was already implemented inside Israel. When we speak about segregation of housing, it was already implemented. When we speak about policy of settlements, it was already implemented. And everyone was saying settlement is obstacle for the peace process. And no one cared. The continuation of the settlement continues. In the whole years, not a single Arab village was built for the Palestinians, although we went from 150,000 population who were able to stay in after 48 to more than a million and a half of the population. We are 20% of the population inside Israel. But most of you, most of the public in the state doesn't hear about us. We are not of existence. We are visible, invisible in Israel as well as in the... So one of the things that we decide to do is not to be invisible anymore. And this trip, we have in the same time different groups going around in different places to bring our voice out and to say that we will not live with this view. The language issue, as Jaffer said, before that, although we have official language, but the status of the Arabic language was very, very bad. Our children, when we speak about our children, in 1992, we began looking at the children literature in the center that we are working with. And And we find that we don't have quality children books for our children. And we don't have any children books or any material that celebrate our heritage and our national identity and our tradition and our culture. Like when we have these we looked at the books for children from birth to three. And we always say that I always say that if the children don't read the book, they won't read it. That it has to be from the very beginning. And normally we say that this book should be out of the tradition, that so that the children can read them before they read the words, so that they can they have this the. Pictures in this book should be from the tradition. So one of the things that we were looking at, we find that most of the children books are printed in Pestalozzi Verlag from Germany, coming to the market without any connection to our culture. So we decided to create these books in our center. And the first book that we did was about me and my food. And we presented for the child a children book with foods that are from our culture. Manoushi, Kusawara, Khubzu Lebani. That's the traditional Arabic food that are representing our culture. And that the children could read, could identify, could see that this is something from their heritage, from their housing. That was the beginning of our children literature. Today, this year, we produced a series of books around the destroyed villages. And we call it Quran al-Baqiya Fina, the villages that are staying with us. And it is a three book story books. That is, one is the Fisher of Bassa, the second is the Poet from Berwi, and the third is the Painter from Sajara. Of course, the Poet from Berwi is Mahmoud Darwish, and the Painter from Sajara is Najil Ali. And we present them as children books, as quality children books with wonderful drawing, with a beautiful scene, and the issue is to make this the children, our children, connect emotionally to these stories. I mean, with children, you can't speak about history. You can't speak about the destroyment of the village. They won't understand it. But when the village names will be part of their life, they will ask the question. And it is about them, the mother and the father and the family, to discuss, to inform, to make a visit for these villages, and we still can visit these villages. So this kind of work that we did was about our existence, about our identity. And we did a lot of other resources that are related to our culture. We had, for example, one is about plants. We know in our the Palestinian identity is when you look and you ask in workshop and what combined this identity? How come I am a proud Palestinian? How could I be a proud Palestinian? When I was born in Israel. I was born in 1955. So I was born in, and I went to school in Israel. The schools in Israel don't speak about us, don't present our culture, don't present our history. So how come I am Palestinian? And we asked this question, and we identified that there are different elements that are combining our history and building constructing our identity. One of them is our experience with the plants. Plants we eat, we drink, we have them as a treatment, we have them as food, we have them as basic food in our kitchen. So it is one of the elements, of course. There are different other elements, but this one, for when we want to make it concrete for our children, we need to present these kind of experiences. And the today experience with planets, when my mother used to take us to the mountain to collect our za'atar, today we are not allowed to collect the za'atar, because za'atar became to be a product that a kibbutz is is planting and selling, and za'atar was put in the list of the plants that you are not under protection. Now za'atar in its component, you have to understand za'atar itself can't live if you don't collect it. You cut it, it won't. If you don't cut it, it doesn't grow in the same way as it is. And when we're speaking about sustainable development, I always say my mother taught me the sustainable development. When we went to collect the za'atar, she said, "Don't cut it from the cut only the pieces that you that." She was looking for the next year to come back and to find the za'atar. So when you put the za'atar under control, under protection, you are actually putting the za'atar for destruction. Nothing about the... And you go today to some of these places where the za'atar grow still, and you will see that the za'atar went back, that it's weak, it's not... anymore. So we're speaking about the reality of this law. The implication of this law has been a policy that we are struggling against, and we are fighting against, and building our own alternative direction. The direction is for life. Our direction is for loving this life and loving this country and loving our heritage. Because we believe that if you are a proud Palestinian, only when you are a proud Palestinian, you can be in any connection with any other. You can't accept the others without accepting yourself. There is no coexistence without the existence. There is no possibility for respecting the others and the difference of the others when you don't respect yourself, and when you don't respect your heritage, and when you don't respect your identity. The only, because I am proud Palestinian, I can be in communication with my friends in the Jewish community, and we can look for common struggle, and we can look for common interest, and we can build a better future for all. This is actually what it's all about. And this is today, we are in a new level. We are in a new level. So the struggle against this law brought us in the new level. It doesn't mean that all the other challenges are per se. The challenges are still and continue, and we have to continue struggling, but we have to look for new possibilities. One of the possibilities that Schaffer was mentioning is the fact that the international advocacy, we have been working on international advocacy for years. Like in the Women Organization, we have been, since 1997, we have been writing a shadow report about the status of Palestinian women inside Israel and presenting it to the CEDAW Commission. Since the first report that Israel reported, Israel have the ratified the CEDAW Convention, and as ratified, they are obliged to present a report for the Commission of the CEDAW. So in 1996, we knew that Israel had presented a first report about the status of women inside Israel. That report, that first report, was about 14 pages. About the status of the women in Israel. 14 pages, and we were not mentioned in that report, except for two sentences, one for being Christian and one it's for the Muslim, and it was used, the fact this diversity within the community was used to accuse us of the fact that there is the bad condition of the Palestinian women. So we decided to write a shadow report, and we began with coalition, that began to write. We needed resources. 1997, there wasn't resources about Palestinian women. We had to be our research. We have to research. It's not like today we have a lot of new scholars that are interested in the Palestinian community and that they write and they publish. At that time, we didn't have the resources. So we have ourselves to begin researching and writing the Shadow Report. And our Shadow Report became a book. And Israel knew that we are organizing, so they withdrew their first report from the commission, and they didn't brought that report. And they asked a scholar from Tel Aviv University, Bar Ilan University at that time, to write a new report. So I always say to my feminist friends, the Jewish friends, it is because of our struggle you have a better report than I. That's real story. And I'm sharing with you a real story. Until today, every five years, whenever Israel is writing a report, we as a coalition write a new shadow report.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we look at social media censorship, recent purges of U.S.-based independent media under the guise of political disinformation. For the hour, we'll be discussing online and internet censorship. Our guests include Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News and Patty Beers of The Anti-Media. Please stay with us.
Forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. We won. The people together can overcome the system. We won.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're going to be looking at censorship online. A very recent story involved Facebook purging U.S.-based independent media, calling it spam, political disinformation. And we have with us today a returning guest. We're very delighted, in fact, to have her return to the program, because her news outlet was one of the ones that was writing about this issue as soon as it happened, October 12. And Manar Mahawish, Chase Palmieri, is going to properly introduce you. So, Chase?
Manar Mahawish is founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of Mint Press News, and is also a regular speaker on responsible journalism, sexism, neoconservatism within the media and journalism startups. She started her career as an independent multimedia journalist covering Midwest and national politics while focusing on civil liberties and social justice issues, posting her reporting and exclusive interviews on her blog, Mint Press, which she later turned into Mint Press News, the global news source it is today. In 2009, Mahawish also became the first American woman to wear the hijab to anchor and report the news in American media. Manar, thanks for joining us again today on the show.
Thank you so much.
So, Manar, mintpressnews.com. Of course, Project Censored listeners are not new to you or your work. You've been in our books. You've been on our show. We've done events together. You will be at the Media Freedom Summit at College of Marin coming up here October 26 and 27. You're one of the keynote people Friday night the 26th, and you certainly have a lot to say. So let's whet people's appetite here today on the Project Censored Show. October 12, Whitney Webb, writing for your website, wrote about the Facebook purges. So tell us about this. Facebook announced that it was removing more than 800 pages from its platform, accusing the pages of, quote, inauthentic behavior, even though the pages produced legitimate content. So writes Whitney Webb at MintPressNews.com. So, Manar, let's talk about this.
Yeah, so October 12th, we're calling it the Facebook Purge, the Purge Day, when Facebook basically announced that they were purging, deleting the pages of over 800 independent media outlets, several activist pages as well. And they basically, Facebook basically accused these pages of producing clickbaity headlines and not following the Facebook rules that they have, being spam and spamming users. When if you take a look at what most of these pages have been producing, some of the top ones we look at are like Anti-Media, the Free Thought Project, writers like Rachel Blevins, and then other activists like Nick Burnaby, Carrie Widler. The purge first began on Facebook, then it followed again as if it had a coordinated effort on Twitter. And if you look at these pages, those specific ones, they produce a lot of anti-establishment news. They are watchdog journalism. They're independent media. Yes, they are for profit, but so is like BuzzFeed and Huffington Post and all of these other news organizations that are retweeting and posting things online. And what's really ironic is that Facebook got rid of these pages because they were so-called spamming users. I mean, if they really, really cared about spam, I mean, you'd think that they would go after organizations like BuzzFeed, where most of their news is spam and really annoying and, you know, cat videos and so forth. So it's no coincidence that they targeted these organizations. These organizations produce a lot of independent watchdog-style journalism and blog posts. They provide a lot of coverage on the national security state, on the police state, and the war machine. They're very anti-interventionist. They're not necessarily right or left. Look at their coverage. Most of these pages are nonpartisan, and they basically promote a pro-peace, anti-establishment message that is very similar to what we do at Mint Press or what you guys do at Project Censored. So there's it's definitely not a coincidence that those pages were targeted.
So, Manar, when you say that these pages were purged, can we get a little bit more specific? Are these pages removed completely from Facebook? Are they temporarily banned? What is the actual result for the audience on Facebook?
They were removed. They were deleted off of Facebook, and they were suspended off of Twitter. So you can't access their Facebook pages. You can't access their Twitter pages. Facebook has not provided an answer or response to them when they tried to appeal. I think all of the pages that I mentioned had tried to appeal to get their pages back because many of these pages had several millions of followers. They were very, very influential. Whenever they posted something, a lot of their articles would go viral. I mean, I know the Free Thought Project, one of the last articles that they had posted right before their page was taken down was about police brutality, and it had almost reached nearly a million people, which is a lot on Facebook. So now they've been completely removed, and the users, people that went and clicked like, that chose to follow those pages, don't have access to those pages anymore.
Right, and I see one of the organizations or pages that was removed was Police the Police, which I've been a fan of and following for a long time. Were all of these pages also removed from Instagram, which is owned by Facebook?
I believe at first they were only removed from Facebook, then I think Twitter followed, and then I believe Instagram followed as well. Instagram is also owned by Facebook, yes.
So, Manar Mahawish, I just wanted to chime back in here. According to the article, Free Thought Project, 3.1 million likes, Anti-Media, 2.1 million, Cop Block, 1.7 million, Police to Police, 1.9 million. These are sites that have been disappeared. And again, in the article, this is something we talked about last month on the Project Censored show. We had a whole program on First Amendment issues, free press issues, so-called deplatforming. You know, first they came for Alex Jones. Well, of course, first they came for lots of people. Alex certainly wasn't the first, but certainly Alex was a big tree in that forest in terms of controversial websites, InfoWars, who actually was known for publishing myths and disinformation and was almost a performance artist, according to his own attorney. But again, you know, when we had this conversation, you know, we still talked about the significance of free expression and why censorship can be a very, very slippery slope. And it didn't take long until now these social media sites are able to see, well, not too much of an outcry over dropping Jones, so maybe we can go after these other sites. And I said, again, these are a lot of anti-establishment or far-right, far-left sites. These are far outside the field of so-called mainstream establishment politics. But the reasoning some of these sites have received some reasons, and they include spam. They include violating community standards. Those are obviously vague things as well. But in your case, what I wanted to talk about, since you and Chase were just talking about Instagram, you actually had some direct issues with Instagram, and you were writing about, well, why don't you tell the story?
Right. The day of the purge, not only were pages like Cop Lock and Police the Police and Anti-Media and Free Thought and several other activist pages removed, but they had actually targeted several of our posts on Instagram and other pages' posts as well on Instagram the day of the purge and flagged them as inappropriate. For instance, we had published a cartoon by the very brilliant and internationally renowned cartoonist Carlos Latouf from April, and it was flagged the day of the purge on October 12th for inappropriate symbols. And what this cartoon had brilliantly depicted was an Israeli sniper with the Israeli flag. The sniper was targeting a journalist covering Israel's massacre in Gaza during the Great Return March. And so here we are as journalists, as the media, portraying and illustrating for the public the crimes that are being committed against humanity in Gaza. And instead of maybe purging like sites, you know, we don't want any purging to take place, but just ironically, instead of flagging pages like Benjamin Netanyahu, who promotes racism and apartheid on his Facebook and Twitter page, they're going after real, actual journalism that's holding the establishment accountable. And in this case, it was holding apartheid Israel accountable for its crimes in Gaza. And what's really interesting about this whole purge, and I've heard a lot of people say this, is that Instagram's a private entity, and so is Twitter. But the real deal is sure, they may be a corporation, but the government has outsourced its spying machine and its censorship machine to Facebook and to these social media giants. So that, you know, because the First Amendment issue, even though the government probably doesn't matter whether it's the First Amendment issue or not, as we know, you know, we're being spied on anyways, via the national security state. But now they've outsourced these First Amendment right issues to these organizations. You know, they're getting basically the full freedom to censor and do whatever they want to under the banner of spamming or clickbait headlines, and it's hurting our business and hurting other businesses.
Manar, we've been talking a lot on the show in the last few weeks about whether or not these platforms should be considered as digital town squares and therefore regulated in some way. But I do have a question for you. Is the timing of this purge as it leads into the midterm significant, or is it in some way unfair to blame Facebook for the timing since they're being told by Congress to act in advance of U.S. elections?
No, there's no coincidence, and I do believe that the midterm elections are playing a huge role in when this purge took place. I mean, we're talking about pages that have several millions of followers that are very influential online. If you've been paying attention, Mint Press, Free Thought Project, and Anti-Media were blacklisted when we were targeted in a list by Propernot, which is like this hawkish, McCarthyist arm of the Atlantic Council, right after the 2016 election. And we were targeted and listed as Russian bots that were influencing the 2016 election in favor of Trump and against Hillary Clinton. So basically we got blamed, and also Truthdig was on there, and several other, you know, very far-right organizations and some, yes, indeed, fake news organizations. But then they also kind of clumped us in there. And so we were targeted and blacklisted right after the 2016 election. So I do not find it coincidental at all that right now, right before the elections and right after that congressional hearing, that the Atlantic Council, a hawkish, NATO-funded, Saudi-funded, Israeli-funded, U.S. government-funded pro-war organization that has partnered up with Facebook, who blacklisted us, is now targeting these organizations, including Mint Press. We haven't been purged yet. We're a social media partner with Anti-Media, and we work with some of the people that were purged. So that's why it hit so close to home to us. We haven't been purged yet, but we have a very strong feeling that we will be purged because we were on that list, and so are other independent media organizations. So there's no question, there's no doubt that this is not a coincidence that it's ahead of the 2018 midterm election.
So, Manar, you're saying that you fully expect Mint Press News to also be purged in the coming weeks or months?
I have a feeling that it could happen to us. I don't know for sure, but the reason why I have that feeling is that this latest purge is not the first purge. Yes, sure, we did have the Alex Jones purge off of social media, But Facebook has been slowly but surely purging smaller organizations. I have been contacted by a number of pages and activists that have had their pages removed without warning from Facebook over the last year. So they've slowly but surely been doing this. This time, I think the timing made the story a lot more interesting, and also we've been giving it a little bit more attention. But I do think that the purge is coming in cycles. This is not the first nor the last purge that's going to take place. And I have a feeling that Mint Press, Truth Dig, possibly a lot of the other independent and alternative media will be purged. Next time, maybe they'll just say it outright that we're informing people that we're causing too much dissent in this country.
Manar Mahawesh, Mint Press News. That language was used in the summer regarding Alex Jones. In fact, WikiLeaks even tweeted, quote, "The empire strikes back. Apple, Spotify, Facebook, and Google, YouTube all purge InfoWars Alex Jones. Yes, InfoWars has frequent nonsense, but also a state power critique. Which publisher in the world with millions of subscribers is next to be wiped out for cultural transgression?" Well, that's a pretty great question, and it looks like it's just been answered in the last week or so over at Facebook. And Caitlin Johnstone, who writes a lot about these things from Australia, actually wrote about the corporatist system of government, and corporate sponsorship then can't really be seen as completely separate from state censorship, given the outsourcing that you meant prior. But now this is going to make things quite sticky. It's a really complicated potential First Amendment issue regarding a free press, which says Congress shall make no laws, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Right? And so this is, again, the gray area. Your response to that?
I think I'm going to have to agree with you. I mean, that's exactly what's happening. I think Chase had mentioned, can there be regulation or so forth of these corporations? I don't have the answer to that. But this is the definition of corporatism right here, where corporations are working hand in hand with the U.S. government to outsource the kinds of things that the U.S. government knows it can't get away with right away. And so we are now a victim to this kind of corporate state of control. We're turning more and more into an Orwellian state, and it's really, really frightening.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with Manar Mahawesh of Mint Press News about internet censorship. We'll be back after this musical break to continue our conversation with Manar Mahawesh. Stay with us.
I always feel like somebody's watching me, and I have no privacy.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're talking about internet censorship, including the recent purge, as it's been referred to by Facebook, of over 800 sites of activists and other journalistic organizations or political organizations. We're speaking now with the founder of Mint Press News, mintpressnews.com, Manar Mahawesh. And Manar, Mint Press News, of course, has been a target of some of these big tech platforms. And of course, you mentioned Instagram earlier before the break and how one of your posts about an editorial cartoon from a reputable cartoonist was censored because of its critique of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And so whether or not one agrees or disagrees with that kind of message, that's entirely legitimate political perspective that people have the right to hear and express. And so that is the kind of thing that is going along sort of baby with the bathwater. We mentioned, you know, of course, Alex Jones and some of these other arguably troublesome sources that had been purged. And so people say, well, I don't mind if that goes away. But what's going to happen when something like Mint Press goes away? What's going to happen when you mentioned earlier Truth Dig or Truth Out or our friend Dave Lindorf, if this can't be happening, or Counterpunch? I know you mentioned Propernot, and we're probably going to get into Propernot with PM Beers, our next guest, because the site she was working at, Antimedia, that's been purged. And at Project Censor, we wrote a lot about Prop or not. But I wanted to come back to that issue because of the outsourcing of intelligence. I mean, we know that Silicon Valley, big tech firms, we know that there's a lot of surveillance money coming through the government that's going into these big tech firms. We know there's no real firewall between Intel and military industrial complex and the surveillance and tech firms. You'd mentioned the Atlantic Council. It's the arm of NATO, propaganda arm of NATO. They're one of the organizations that's deciding what's fake news. The Weekly Standard, which is a right-wing publication. Nothing wrong with a right-wing publication, per se, but certainly not the kind of organization you'd go to, nor NATO, as any objective arbiter of facts in journalism.
Absolutely. And that's who we're seeing right now being the fact checkers. And before they came along, we had organizations like the Washington Post and BuzzFeed being assigned as fake news checkers for Facebook as well. So it slowly has evolved into basically putting who controls our news into the hands of the war machine, of the very organizations that media and journalism is supposed to be holding accountable. Well, now they are the ones who are basically playing thought police in America. And so it's a really, really dangerous slope. Facebook is being nicknamed Fascist Book because now they're acting as a fascist organization where they're trying to control what people see, hear, and read. And if we are all purged, I mean, what's going to be left? We are going to be left with organizations like the Weekly Standard or BuzzFeed or Washington Post or Huffington Post or CNN as the ones who are going to be providing our news. And who are those? I mean, those organizations are the corporate mainstream media spewing and promoting the very lies that bring us the wars. They're the ones who are dehumanizing the victims of our war. They're the ones who are convincing us that our water is safe to drink, our food is okay, GMOs, non-organic food is okay. They're the ones who are propagating for the establishment on a daily basis. And so if we're gone, no one's going to be holding them accountable. So I think the time is now where we need to come up with an alternative. The biggest challenge we've had in moving to alternative platforms like WeMe or Minds or other, you know, social media organizations or platforms that don't believe in censorship and they're more independent is that while we move, the users are not moving. And so people are so addicted to going on Facebook. They're so addicted to going on Twitter and on Instagram and these major platforms because we are surrounded with these platforms everywhere we go. I mean, we know that we're going to get all of our news from Facebook, in which now they're going to be controlling. They're controlling our news. And so I think the next question is how can we find and build a new alternative where people can go and feel like they're getting the kind of news that they deserve? Another question I have is how do we get more and more people to care? I think when Alex Jones was purged, I think that was kind of used as a, well, Alex Jones is crazy, so we need to support censorship. You know, that's how Facebook and these organizations got the public to support censorship, because they took somebody who is literally like an actor providing pure entertainment, who's spewing lies and fake news and just entertainment, not real news, and he was banned. They almost made it like it's okay to do that. So now not as many people care.
Fighting fake news is the Trojan horse for censorship. Right. So now these platforms can say, well, we've been told that we got to get rid of these fake news sites. And then they throw 800 of them together. Now, granted, some of them were duplicates. Some of them are 40 sites run by one person. So maybe, yes, maybe that is spam. Maybe that is something that needs to be addressed. Again, we've been writing about this for the last couple of years. And here we are, more fever pitch than ever about it. There's numerous of these kinds of sources that are being purged or being deplatformed that are, whether you agree with them or not, they're legitimate journalistic outlets. They may have unpopular ideological perspectives, but they are legitimate historical ideological perspectives nonetheless.
Yeah, and Minar, when Facebook makes a decision to purge these pages, they claim that the pages in some way violated the community's terms of service. Now, I'm wondering if you've and your team have looked into this at all, whether or not this is actually a decision being made at the top of all of these tech platforms. Like, is it Zuck himself making the call? Because I don't understand how all of these pages could violate the terms of service overnight.
Well, they did define a couple of the terms of service in an article. I think it was the LA Times. These pages had violated the terms of service by spamming and using clickbait headlines.
When is CNN going to get shut down?
Exactly.
When will Fox News go away?
Exactly. And I don't have it out for BuzzFeed on purpose, but I really believe BuzzFeed is like one of the main spammers that we have that exists in the media today. But what's really ironic is Facebook is making it nearly impossible for any page to reach their own followers. And if you actually look back at Facebook tweets, we actually uncovered a tweet from, I believe, 2 years ago where Facebook admitted that they were suppressing the reach of independent organizations and certain organizations by 80%. They were suppressing their reach by 80%. So here we are, we have this scenario where Facebook is suppressing all of us by 80% because we know we're being flagged for the kind of coverage that we're providing by covering war, by covering the police state, by covering the national security state, et cetera, et cetera. And then they make it nearly impossible. So when these websites, anti-media or pre-thought project, try to enhance their articles and their titles to get more attention on Facebook, Facebook is using that as the reason. But if you actually look at another article that just came out right after the purge from the New York Times, it blatantly stated that these pages were being targeted, and it was celebrating it, by the way.
So, Manar, I want to go back to that, proper not, and we're going to be talking about that, of course, probably in the second half of the show, but that goes back to National Security Editor Craig Timberg, Marty Baron, the senior editor there. They published this article putting proper not on the map, didn't tell anybody who they were, where their funding was, what their methodology was. And, you know, if you go to see their website now, is it propaganda or not, propernot.com, their tagline is your friendly neighborhood propaganda identification service since 2016. And they have a big headline that says Russia is manipulating U.S. public opinion through online propaganda. Well, perhaps that's partially true, but how is that more relevant than the 24/7 six corporations that run 90% of the media blasting at the American electorate year round? Again, this is a real bait and switch. This is also why now that they have this fake news meme off leash and you have people like Donald Trump screaming about fake news every time he doesn't agree with something, right? So you've got a whole contingent of people that are going to jump on fake news that way, a whole bunch of people that are going to say Trump just doesn't want to face the truth in a post-truth world. This is kind of a crazy, chaotic stew that almost appears as though that it was designed on purpose so that someone could come in and correct the problem that was created. And the correctors of these problems then are supposedly the social media platforms that helped exacerbate them in the first place, where they don't share transparency with how they're doing it. They have what look like autocratic fascist purges, something that we would see in Saudi Arabia, for example. But yet this is supposed to be for the good of our press. This is supposed to be, as you and Chase were saying earlier, coming up on the midterm elections, right? Like this is somehow a response to trying to maintain the integrity of our free press system. Well, does it seem to you, Manar, that that's something that should be monitored or argued in the first place? How much of a free press system do we actually have in the U.S.?
If anything, not only does this expose how little freedom of the press we do have, but it also shows the irony of this whole Russiagate narrative. I mean, move over Russia, here comes Facebook meddling in the United States election, you know, playing thought police. When the media talks about Russian bots influencing the election, we have organizations like Facebook doing exactly that. They are literally controlling what people see and hear and read in terms of news and what they know about the whole election. It's really, really disturbing. In the past 20 years or so, the media has consolidated to such a point, to such a degree, that the news that we get is already controlled by big corporations, like you said. They control over 90% of what we see, hear, and read. And so we had this opportunity. With every crisis, there comes an opportunity. The opportunity came for so many independent and alternative media organizations to erupt, you know, to have a renaissance, to inform the public. And the establishment got terrified with the rise of all these independent and alternative media organizations because we were getting most of our traffic from Facebook. And the majority of our traffic and our rise was coming from Facebook, was coming from Twitter. And so they saw that Twitter and Facebook was a huge threat. And so they know that they had to kind of squeeze us exactly where what we were utilizing.
So, Manar, let's assume that in 3 weeks, Facebook purges Mint Press News from Facebook. What kind of decisions are you going to have to make to still get your content out to your audience? And are you going to have to scale back operations at your own organization? Are you going to have to let people go because now you're not getting the traffic that you used to?
Or will you take legal action?
We've actually had this conversation at Mint Press for the past 2 years. First of all, our readership in itself has gone down since the whole war on fake news and targeting Russian propaganda and so forth was announced right after the 2016 election. Once Facebook began targeting and flagging and suppressing independent and alternative media, our readership in itself has gone down by over 60% from Facebook. And we were getting the majority of our news from Facebook and from Google as well, and our views from YouTube. And so we're not waiting for 3 weeks. We have been discussing this literally for the past 3 years. Looking not only at alternative platforms to be promoting our news, but but also how we can better and enhance the kind of news that we are producing. We've already scaled back. We've already faced budget cuts because of the suppression. Our ad revenue is down also by over 60% because of Google Ads and them removing ads. I mean, Google is like it's another beast. That's like another story. Google's removing ads from political posts, political articles now, and they're threatening to remove even more ads from our website, and that's happening across the board from independent alternative media as well. So they're really squeezing us at every opportunity that they can, and anywhere that they can, they are squeezing us and hurting us. So we've already scaled down on staff. We've already faced budget cuts because of that. And so now we are at the point where we are trying to figure out how do we move forward. And that's kind of one of the things that I was asking about is, you know, we have to figure out, number one, a new platform where we can thrive and survive. And we have to think more multimedia. This is a David versus Goliath scenario. We are up against these major corporations that have, like, unlimited funding. They're producing content constantly. That's everywhere we look. So we have to be really smart and innovative in the ways that we are producing our news. We're already starting to do more videos. We're going to be launching a podcast very soon. And we're scaling down on the quantity that we were producing. I don't know if this is a tactic that other organizations are using, but we're going to be focusing more, instead of on quantity, we're going to be focusing more on quality and using the extra funds that we have to promote the very good work that we're doing. So, for example, something that we've done in the past 6 months is we've kind of axed out a lot of the coverage that we're doing on certain issues to focus more on series reporting, like on what's happening in Yemen. And I feel like that's really, really important that we've done that, because even within the independent alternative media platform, not many people have been giving attention to the genocide that's taking place in Yemen. I mean, there's like 23 million people expected to starve to death by the end of this year. That's like in 2 months.
No, and Manar Mahawish, we talked off air before. I just wanted to interject momentarily. You know, speaking of Saudi Arabia and their slaughter in Yemen with U.S. weapons, quite selective outrage, as we've learned now that Saudi Arabia is admitting through Turkey that they're responsible for the death of Jamal Khashoggi. So, again, there's outrage about this, and there should be outrage all over. But you just mentioned Yemen, and that's a topic that's escaped the corporate media in the United States and U.S.-backed Saudi involvement. That's escaped U.S. media almost entirely.
Absolutely. And if we look at the history of Khashoggi, the journalist, I mean, he is part of the establishment, the national security state of Saudi Arabia, and had very close ties to the CIA. And so it's obviously a tragedy whenever a journalist is killed. But I find it really, really ironic that the entire media establishment is outraged over his death when Saudi Arabia is committing a genocide, like I said, in Yemen, where 23 million people are expected to starved to death by an illegal and inhumane blockade by the end of this year. And I think I've seen like one or two reports from CNN and MSNBC over the last like year on what's happening in Yemen. They're cheerleading U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. I think it's over $3 billion was the latest weapon sale deal from the Trump administration to the Saudis. And so what we're seeing taking place is like this like elitist outrage over this one journalist who was part of the establishment versus outrage that we should be seeing on what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen and in its own country. I mean, Saudi Arabia is like a police state. They're beheading people. They're stoning people. They're crucifying people. I mean, it's 2018. They're crucifying people. They're funding terrorism around the world. Jihadis, they're spreading these Salafist Wahhabi ideology that ignites these terrorist organizations in Syria, in Yemen, Al-Shabaab, in Africa. I mean, they are the ones who are fueling chaos. I mean, they're acting as a proxy for the war machine and as a gravy train for profits for the war machine. So that's where the outrage should be. And that's the kind of coverage that we are bringing at Mint Press. That's the kind of coverage that anti-media has brought attention to the very organizations that were purged. And I think that might also have something to do with the fact that we have been targeted through this suppression campaign.
Manar Mahawish, mintpressnews.com. You can learn more by going to the website. You'll be out here in Northern California, College of Marin, Media Freedom Summit 2.0, Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice, October 26, 27. You're speaking the evening of October 26 with Abby Martin of the Empire Files, Eleanor Goldfield of Act Out, Sarah Lazare of In These Times, Nora Barros-Friedman, Electronic Intifada, a absolutely fantastic all-female lineup for our roundtable keynote, and we'll be honored to have you out here, Manar.
Thank you so much.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we'll continue your conversation about the internet purge and internet censorship with PM Beers. Stay with us.
Now my limit is losing
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. We continue our conversation about the social media purge that has taken place here recently. We were just speaking with Manar Mahawish at Mint Press News, and we laid out some of the details. We're joined in the second half of the program by Patty Beers. She is actually involved in one or more of the sites that was actually taken down. Patty Beers is a political micro-influencer on Twitter, has over 33,000 followers when her account was suspended. In 2012, she began live streaming during the Occupy Wall Street movement and continued documenting political protests, actions, events, as well as Los Angeles Police Department commission meetings, city council meetings, and other political gatherings in Los Angeles. Much of her work is focused on police accountability, certainly around brutality around Black lives. She has been an activist with Black Lives Matter. She was a correspondent for OWS Week television program that aired internationally on Press TV. In 2014, she began writing for the Anti-Media and was their social media manager on Twitter. Patty, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, Mel.
So you have had a busy week dealing with all of the things that have happened regarding Facebook, Twitter, social media. Your account was suspended. Twitter, the Anti-Media was also censored. Can you tell us what's going on here?
I'd really like to know. On Thursday, October 11, in the morning, I heard that 800 pages had been taken off Facebook, and Anti-Media was one of those. That's really upsetting in the first place because that was my job, but these kind of things have been happening in Facebook over a long period of time, so it wasn't that surprising because they kept making it so people couldn't see the posts. So our income had already been cut off. A lot of us were practically volunteering at Anti-Media right before the Facebook thing happened. But then later in the afternoon, just before 4 o'clock, all of my Twitter accounts that I have access to were suspended at once. Over 30 accounts on two different tweet decks. I don't know if people know what a tweet deck is, but it's a way that people can work together. People with different accounts can work together and retweet each other's stuff. And so my tweet deck had 26 accounts on it, and 25 of those were suspended. And I also was part of the Global Revolution Media Collective. They had a bunch of accounts on their tweet deck, and all of their accounts on their tweet deck and accounts that used to be on their tweet deck like a year ago that aren't on there now, all of those accounts were suspended. And now I'm hearing of other people that their Twitter accounts are suspended, and also people who work for Anti-Media. Carrie Wedler from Anti-Media, she's the editor-in-chief of Anti-Media. Her Twitter account was suspended. She rarely even uses Twitter. She said that she would never break any rule, and I believe her integrity on that. And so I don't see why her account was suspended. And other accounts that I barely even use, but I do have access to, like White People for Black Lives Twitter account. White People for Black Lives is connected with Black Lives Matter. They're a group of white people who are supporting Black Lives Matter, and their Twitter account, which I barely ever touched, but just because I had access to it and I had tweeted from it, their account was suspended. I'm kind of thinking, because I'm in the middle of all this, that some of the accounts, the Twitter accounts, were suspended to keep me from tweeting.
You were given a notification.
I did receive the same email that a lot of other people had received from Twitter, and it said that my account was suspended for, I think it said breaking the rule, but it didn't say what the rule was. And I was not given a reason. I've appealed it, and I haven't heard back from them.
Interesting. And the reason that all of the accounts that you're connected with were able to be pulled at the same time, I'm assuming, is because you had the same email, password, and login on all of these different accounts?
No. I have more than one account. They're all in different emails. But then I also have access to other people's accounts.
You have permission to do posting on other people's accounts?
Yes.
You weren't doing something that you're not allowed to do.
This is like working in a team. It's teamwork.
So, Patty Beers, tell us a little bit more on the run up to this. Anything going on at the Anti-Media? Anything going on? Did this just come out of the blue, or were there stages? I mean, I'm not talking about what was going on prior with InfoWars or Alex Jones or the general fake news flap, which we can get into a little bit more if you like. But, I mean, did this just come out of nowhere for Anti-Media and for you in particular?
I would say for me in particular, it came out of nowhere. But for Anti-Media and Facebook pages, it's been a slow progression. being suppressed and suppressed. And even back in January, anti-media had announced that Twitter had cut their reach by over 90% in January. And then that's when everyone who had worked at anti-media were told, we don't know if we could pay you. A lot of us were like, we'll do it for free. I had been paid since then, but like less money because their revenue was just really destroyed in January. So they were hanging on by a thread, and then this happened.
So what is the situation on the ground at anti-media in particular? Does it seem like management might have to let people go? Is the website still going to be around a month from now? How devastating is this blow?
I would say incredibly devastating. Right now, they're still publishing articles, but I don't know if people are getting paid. I don't know if anyone's getting paid. But we've already had this discussion. A lot of people are just kind of volunteering.
So we just had Manar Mahawish, the editor-in-chief of Mint Press News, on as our guest right before you. And we were talking about what it might not be too much of a hypothetical scenario that Mint Press News might be purged from Facebook and other platforms in the very near future as well. It's one thing to ask Manar as a hypothetical, what will you do when this happens? But in the position that you are all in right now, do you feel completely helpless? Is there any recourse?
I don't really see for myself a way out because a lot of people are talking about like moving to other social media platforms. And I don't really see that as effective at this point because everyone's on Facebook or Twitter. That's the most effective way to reach people. And we're telling the news, so we want people to read the news. As far as moving to other platforms, the kind of platforms that are likely to support free speech and not limit it are also, a lot of those are cesspools for white supremacy. So for someone like me, who's like very radically on the far left, I don't really see other platforms that have enough people for that to be an effective place to put all your energy.
Patty, you're no stranger to activism. You were in a row about filming police brutality a few years ago. You have a background going back both in writing and being an activist. It seems, I'd like to hear your view on this. Does it seem then that that kind of a background is the kind of background that's being profiled here?
Well, all the accounts on Twitter and Facebook, I think what we all have in common, anti-authoritarian perspectives. We're all challenging mainstream media narratives. A lot of us are focused on just telling the truth, unfiltered truth from different perspectives that you won't see from the mainstream. So I think that anti-authoritarianism and that questioning of the government, especially, and probably anti-Hillary, too. I think everyone on that pop or not list was probably anti-Hillary.
Patty, I want to play devil's advocate for one second. Let's assume that Facebook is a giant party being held on private property, and you and the anti-media team are in a corner of the party by the water cooler talking about very controversial things. Now, why is it not the case that Facebook could say, okay, well, you're no longer welcome at my party because it's creating some kind of a controversial atmosphere for the rest of my party? Why is that not the case?
Because we're not bothering everyone at your party. The people who want to talk to us are coming to talk to us.
Because they've opted into receiving your content in the first place.
Yeah.
And all those lists of followers, are you able to access that list of followers, or has that disappeared as well?
As far as Facebook, I don't know, but as far as Twitter, no, I cannot.
And you had 30-some thousand?
Over 33,000.
And so you have an appeal into Twitter, correct?
Yeah.
And you said earlier in the conversation you had not heard back.
Oh, I have not heard anything.
Have you contacted any legal teams, anybody out there that you know that maybe could escalate this to a bigger conversation? As Chase was just saying here, this came up in the conversation before, and in previous weeks we've been talking about free press rights, free speech rights, the corporate enclosure of the commons, corporate capture of information disseminating institutions, and the very gray area then that is created as a result of this kind of control of information, that on one hand the government isn't technically censoring information. It's a private company that has rules that is trying to deplatform or silence certain views under, well, let's at least, we can at least say under some sketchy cover. But that seems to be what's happening. And so this is my reason for saying the bringing the legal angle into this is that perhaps it's time to really have a conversation about the nature of these private companies on social media and what they do have the right to do.
Yeah, are any of these companies that were all purged together organizing and maybe thinking about a class action lawsuit? Is there any kind of coordination amongst the purged parties here as they try to fight back and join forces in doing so?
I really don't know anything about that at this point, and I haven't even gotten to the point of legal action. I'm still hoping. All I want is my Twitter account back. I hope that these big groups like anti-media and other groups, and including Mint Press too, because I'm sure Mint Press has lost a lot of money as well. I hope they get together and do something legally. I have no idea where to start or where to go or where to look.
Well, it's very recent. It was also, again, very calculated. You had, 800 overnight. This is going on for a while. They didn't just wake up one day and decide to purge 800 sites. This is something that they've been doing. And actually, I want to maybe posit the same question to you that Chase asked Manar. Do you think the timing of this, coinciding with the run-up to the 2018 election, with the demand from Congress in particular, that social media needs to take its responsibility more seriously and needs to rout out so-called fake news sites? What's your view on that?
I think that probably is the case, and I think that's hysterical because most of these sites are not even for voting. I'm not for voting for people. So as harshly critical I was of Hillary, I would be harshly critical of any politician because I don't vote for people at all. But yeah, I think that the timing of it is about the elections and trying to suppress political dissent, and maybe the motive is to keep the dialogue on the two-party system. People from other alternatives and thinking about other things, and maybe they just want people focused on the Republicans and the Democrats because most of these sites aren't about voting for people.
So PM Beers, Patty Beers, where can people find out or follow more about what's going on here? I know you obviously mentioned you're not on Twitter presently. But could you read out a couple places where people can find you? Maybe do give your Twitter account in case it comes back online. That way, if people are interested, they could contact you, or perhaps somebody in the audience has ideas or suggestions.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm PM Beers on all the social medias.
So that's PMBEERS.
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram. I have a Facebook public page. People can follow my public page. Anybody can follow me on there. I'm on YouTube as well. A lot of my YouTube videos have little clips from people speaking at the police commission meeting.
TheAntiMedia.com is one of the websites that you were associated
for sure.
With.
Go there.
Okay, well, yeah. Patty Beers, we're going to be doing more programs on this, so I'm sure we'll be checking back in with you in coming weeks just to find out what's going on here. And so, again, keep us posted at Project Censored, and we hope to continue to get out the word about these internet deplatformings, as they were, and censorship at places like Twitter. That was our conversation with Patty Beers of the Antimedia, antimedia.com. Chase Palmieri and I will continue our conversation about internet censorship issues after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. For the last minutes of the program today, Chase and I wanted to have a discussion about this because this issue, internet censorship, information freedom, the right to disseminate information, the right to be heard. Right now, again, I'm riffing on the United Nations Article 19 here, International Declaration of Human Rights. Obviously, Project Censored is a very pro-First Amendment organization, but we mentioned earlier in the program that there's some gray area here, public versus private. And, of course, Chase, who is over at tribeworthy.com, who does stuff in media as well. We've had Chase on the program as a guest before. Now he's co-host. Chase and I were talking off air, and there's a few things that we should bring up. And one of these issues, Chase, was?
Well, one of the issues with proposing regulation on big tech social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter is that only these giant, already rich and already having made it platforms can actually comply with these regulations, and that it might stifle competitions and upstarts from coming in and stealing these audiences away from Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
Let's take a look at this then again, because we know social media CEOs have been hauled in front of Congress with a big finger wag after the 2016 election, right? That a lot of the blame, plenty of blame to go around, whether it was Russia or fake news or Bernie-crats or whatever you want to call this, whatever the blame was. One of them was fake news. One of them was fingering social media in general. Of course, the trope that Russia somehow was able to influence all these votes is I suppose, interesting one, if ever absurd. That doesn't mean that Russia wasn't taking out ads or that the Russian government doesn't have interest in U.S. elections. But realistically, we have a lot of other forces right here at home in the United States that are interested in disseminating propaganda. But the social media companies said that that wasn't what they did, right? The social media companies went to Congress and said, well, we're not journalists. We're not information institutions. We're social platforms. What can you add to that, Chase, about this argument?
Well, I guess the argument they're trying to make is that they are in some way free and open platform, allowing the people, the guests on their platform, to say whatever they want and then allow the people to opt into that content by these kind of follower-following feature sets. And that seemed to have been the case for a very long time, at least in the early days. But it seems more and more heavy-handed by some of the tech entrepreneurs at each of these organizations now. So if you look at the Facebook purge that we've been talking about on today's show, so many of these pages were purged overnight. And I find it very hard to believe that the community service people, the people at Facebook and Twitter that make sure they uphold the community terms of service, that they didn't go to the top executives and say, hey guys, we've got 800 pages here that we're ready to purge. Should I go ahead and hit that button? I find it very hard to believe that there wasn't a single person or a small, small group of people at the top of each of these organizations that ultimately made that decision. And then the question is that okay? Are we fine with letting these tech oligarchs decide who can and cannot be heard? And if not, what is the recourse? And if the recourse is that we have to wait and hope that 5 years from now, a competitor to Facebook comes up and somehow doesn't get bought or acquired by Facebook?
Like MeWe?
Yeah, like MeWe. Or even the fact Instagram was a direct threat to Facebook, but then Congress allows these giant media conglomerates to acquire more media conglomerates as they come up and become a competitor. And Facebook knows very well who is coming up and stealing traffic away from them, probably even before Congress could keep an eye out for it, or the rest of the market even knows the valuation of these companies should be. So it's easy for Facebook to come swoop in on Instagram as they see Instagram stealing their traffic and say, hey, we're going to buy you for $1 billion, when in reality, if the company had stayed private or stayed at least as its own entity, it would be worth hundreds of billions of dollars today and might have destroyed this kind of weird monopoly that we're experiencing with this Facebook purge.
Well, it's an oligopoly of sorts of control. But again, branches of government and agencies of government are not separate from the big tech sector, as we mentioned earlier. Seed money, tax money, military industrial complex money, surveillance money, NSA money, that was all instrumental going back in the early days of Google. Silicon Valley is no shortage of people that sort of had a real interest in controlling information. The CIA has long been interested in this. In fact, Facebook has been criticized as sort of being one of the most brilliant surveillance platforms ever because we give everything to it and they have proprietary rights over our own lives, our images, etc. It does, however, it seems a little bit problematic whenever government claims that they're not involved in any of this kind of censorship, and that's a private company's decision, when these kinds of private companies are working with government and corporate-funded think tanks like the Atlantic Council, the propaganda arm of NATO. When they are working with these kinds of organizations, they're not objective organizations. They're not third party in that regard. They have this bizarre symbiotic relationship, and now Facebook is relying on Atlantic Council to tell it what is fake news. So you see these kinds of purges. It doesn't surprise me, and it doesn't surprise anybody at Project Censored, that these kinds of anti-establishment or sites critical of the status quo, whether they're on the left, like some of the stuff at Mint Press News certainly is, or on the right. The executive director over at the Ron Paul Institute was suspended. So, I mean, it's on both sides of the spectrum.
Right. And speaking about purges, Facebook acquired Instagram and WhatsApp, and those founders who then became absorbed into the Facebook machine have actually, in the last 2 weeks, the co-founders of Instagram have purged themselves and they've left Facebook, leaving millions of dollars on the table. And as well as the co-founders of WhatsApp left even earlier and even created the hashtag delete Facebook. So it's worth noting that these competitor platforms, WhatsApp and Instagram, were bought out by Facebook as soon as the opportunity presented itself, and then they grew under Facebook, and then for whatever reason, there's enough argument or controversy between the original founders of these platforms and Mark Zuckerberg that these founders have walked away from their babies and left millions of dollars of vested equity on the table.
Well, we're certainly not done with this topic, and it seems that as more and more of this kind of action takes place, we see more censorship, more deplatforming, it's certainly going to come up. Recently spoke with journalist Eric Dratzer, who does Counterpunch Radio as well as Stop Imperialism. He's contributed to Project Censored over the years. Dratzer, playing devil's advocate, also said, yeah, a lot of these sites are talking about how traffic is down, but to his knowledge, he couldn't point a finger to show where it was something that was specifically being done algorithmically or who was to blame for it, even though Eric Schmidt over at Google said that they would be doing it. But in other words, it's sort of saying like, well, okay, but is this something that we're just repeating over and over again? And if not, who has the actual evidence that this is taking place, and then for what reason? And hopefully we'll be doing a show on this sometime in the coming weeks.
Right. And another thing that you just brought up is these algorithms. Now, a lot of people complain about the algorithms. In reality, we, the audience, decide what algorithms we like because the ones that we stay on the site longer for are the ones that ultimately become implemented. But it's worth noting that none of these algorithms that decide what we see in the newsfeed are ever shared publicly, and for good reason, because these are private companies that would not want to share their what is essentially their intellectual property. So we're never going to know why we see what we see on these private companies. Social media platforms.
Well, that's very problematic. And at the Project Censored show, we often end things problematically because there'll be more to discuss later. And of course, we certainly will. So Chase Palmieri, great to be in conversation here. And I'd like to thank our guest today, Manar Mahawish, as well as Patty Beers. I'd like to remind listeners that not only is this the Project Censored show, but our latest book, Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion by Andy Lee Roth, myself, is out and available. You can learn more at projectcensored.org, published by Seven Stories Press in New York. Again, one of the prime things that Andy and I have been writing about the last couple of books in the so-called post-truth world of alternative facts is that critical media education, critical media literacy education, rather than censorship, blacklist, privatized fact checkers, or legislative bans, is the best weapon for fighting the ongoing fake news invasion. October 26, 27, Media Freedom Summit. Learn more at projectcensored.org. We've got a stellar lineup of people that are going to be helping us fight the fake news invasion. And we'll also be wrapping up some shooting of a fake news documentary that'll be out early next year. So stay tuned for that.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program, with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, and thanks to our associate producers, Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archived programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram while we're still there, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast app. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
Political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons make effects paid for. I tax them all the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love of the brothers and our sisters. Mission, we wanna crowd out, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We got the love of the brothers and
from studios of KPFA in Berkeley, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, produced in partnership with Arab Studies Institute. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I am Mira Nabulsi. Ever since a fishmonger was crushed to death in November of 2016 by a garbage compactor in Al Husseima, the northern reef region of Morocco has been the scene of social unrest and protest against the Moroccan government, a movement that has been spreading to other parts of the country over the past 2 years.
The demands are actually quite basic. The demand should be read in light of the regional history and politics, which, as you already mentioned, marginalized and I would say purposely de-developed for a long time since independence, and people have faced difficulties in terms of employment, education, basic facilities, healthcare, etc. So the demands were kind of focusing on the social economic conditions.
This week, we get an update on the protest movement in Morocco with Moroccan anthropologist Miriam Aourak. Bay Area-based activist and after-school teacher Heather Lamastro talks with us about her Pen Pal project connecting kids in the Bay Area with kids in the Gaza Strip, and also about her humanitarian visit to the besieged Gaza Strip. Stay with us. Ever since a fishmonger was crushed to death in November 2016 by a garbage compactor in Al Husseima, the northern reef region of Morocco has been the scene of social unrest and protest against the Moroccan government, a movement that has been spreading to other parts of Morocco over the past 2 years. Miriam Aourak Asfar, senior lecturer at the University of Westminster in London, has been researching the issue and interviewing people on the ground. Khalil spoke with her in Amsterdam upon her return from the reef.
Welcome back to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, Miriam Asfar. It's great to have you with us today. Since last time we talked, which was 8 months ago, has any progress been made? Are the Moroccan authorities listening to the popular demands, or are we still in the same basic situation we were a few months ago?
A lot has happened. As you may be aware, and maybe as a sort of recap, a large group of activists who are considered somehow the cadre of the organizers in Al Husseima and beyond in the reef were arrested on very suspicious charges, among them the famous Nasser Zefzafi. It has been a cruel year for the activists. The punishments and repercussions were very harsh, and it had been very tense because there weren't any trials. So a lot of the protests continued and turned into protests for demands for the release of the political prisoners. In the meantime, there has been a series of trials, and it created an enormous shock, because while everybody sort of thought or hoped And anyone with a rational mind or understanding of the legal system, broadly speaking, would have expected them to be released because there really was no serious charge except for going out and protesting. The result was the opposite. The trials were like a show process, and the sort of the prisoners were given between 10 to 20 years, which really, I think, caused a ripple in society. The anger multiplied, actually, by that. The government system, Mohsen, probably thought that it would sort of, you know, close off the situation and this sort of chapter in the current history, but it actually intensified the anger and the protest.
We're talking about the court in Casablanca that sentenced 39 people, including Nassar Zefzafi, to terms of up to 20 years in jail.
Exactly. And of course, I mean, the people that we know mostly, the visible people, are talked about and written about, but the number is much larger. So around 300 people have been arrested. The last development was that people had expected the king to do his annual speech around the Eid al-Adha.
The major Muslim holiday, the second major.
Which is often an occasion to also offer amnesty or all kinds of different, you know. That didn't happen, but then, or the Eid al-Ash, the King's Day speech, people also expected. But then finally, one of the major king speeches, he actually went to Al-Husayma to give a speech, which was quite unique.
Al-Husayma is this small town in a region that's been largely marginalized in Morocco in the north.
The birthplace of the protest. It's where Mohsen Fikri was killed, whose death was sparked the major protest.
So it's been all repression so far. No carrot, all stick.
The carrot was, so in one of the speeches, finally, the king announced an amnesty for about 180 prisoners, 188, I think. But among, so very important, of course, and for all those hundreds of people, relatives, friends, spouses, it was a major thing. And we were all very happy for them. But there was at the same time a terrible sadness because the core group or the cadre, among them Zefzafi, were not given amnesty, and their sentencing was upheld. So people are still facing the prospect of rotting away in prison, basically, in Morocco. So that is the latest major development.
So why don't you remind us the central demands? You said that the whole protest movement was triggered by the death of this fishmonger who was just trying to make a living and whose catch was confiscated and tossed. Mm-hmm. And his death provoked this movement. What are some of the central demands other than now the release of the protesters?
The demands are actually quite basic. The demand should be read in light of the regional history and politics, which, as you already mentioned, marginalized and I would say purposely de-developed for a long time since independence, and people have faced difficulties in terms of employment, education, basic facilities, healthcare, etc. So the demands were kind of focusing on the social economic conditions. So the demands were proper hospital, education, like a university. There's no university, there's no proper higher education in the region. And also very important, of course, in light of the political activism, the demilitarization of the region. So that was also a major demand. The region is since independence, militarized in the sense that around Al-Husayma and the province of Al-Husayma, you could imagine, in a way, checkpoints and other sort of military facilities that sort of controls the movement of people coming in and out. And of course, people living there have always, for generations, felt that their personal freedom and autonomy was undermined, that they were criminalized by the presence, of course, of a military system. So that is also a major part of the demand.
So it feels like an occupied territory, basically. Why is the Moroccan government doing this to the Reef region? Remind us a little bit of the history.
Well, the history of Morocco in general is complex and interesting at the same time. The independence process was quite different from, for instance, the independence that was experienced experience in Algeria, which was a revolutionary project, anti-colonial in and out. The potential for this to also occur in Morocco was very great because Morocco also had a resistance movement, an independence movement. But the presence of, for instance, a sultanate, a kind of dynasty, which then became also the kingdom, played a different role in the political power balances between the local sort of, you know, elite governments and the colonizers. In Morocco, additionally, also the complexities can be found in the fact that it was colonized by two major imperial countries, namely Spain and France. Skip the complex history and the French occupation and focus on the north. The major interactions between the local resistance groups was with Spain, because Spain occupied the north and what is globally referred to as the Rif. The Rif region had a quite intense and heroic history of resistance. Many people who know the region and you know, are interested in Middle East or North African politics know of the name Abdelkrim al-Khattabi, who was a famous anti-imperialist, anti-colonial figure who actually hit a dent in the Spanish colonizing presence. They were almost basically defeated by local rebellion groups led by Abdelkrim al-Khattabi. This, you have to also understand, was on the one hand, of course, very heroic and important for the local people, but also was a warning to whoever may come in place of the colonizers, whoever may be in charge of the country, that it's a region, a regional politics that they have to take into account. They have their own history and their own will, and they are able also to impose their will. And so people feel that they have been regarded as a thorn in the eye of the new upcoming national elites who wanted to control the country top down, including the north of the Rif. And so that history of tension between regional politics and the central political system of Rabat has always been there. And so that feeling of isolation is both physical, military presence in order to maintain control and prevent any potential rebellion, but also the sense of isolation coming from the fact that they have been regarded by many as a threat to the interests of the national, you could say the national bourgeoisie, the nationalist component of the state. And that is an unfinished business. It has been there for as long as independence, and it has not really been dealt with until recently. There have been some developments in the region in the north, investments in the coastal areas, new marina, new sort of port, not very important in all honesty, but it gives the people a feeling that the government is willing to invest, but it is mainly in the interests of a handful of, you could say, very rich investors. Local people do not benefit from any projects or infrastructures or investments. And basically what you see is what we've seen in many post-colonial situations, where a sort of neoliberal capitalist injection is inserted in some place, but not for the sake of ordinary people's living standard. On the outside, things look like, oh, well, it has been developed and there's a lot of attention and goodwill. But once you scratch the surface, and that is what happened with the death of Mohsin Fikri, because it showed that people don't have any access to the fish. They aren't allowed to sell them. Those natural resources have been monopolized and privatized, and not for the benefit of the people themselves, but for big companies. So that is kind of, to cut a long story short, the social, economic, and political background of the current protest and continuation of the protest.
Thank you for this panoramic summarizing of Morocco's modern history. It appears as if the Rif, because of its independence and its history of resistance, is actually perceived as a threat by the monarchy more than anything else. And what you were briefly describing is this neo-colonial situation where now the state is Moroccan, but the area of the Rif still feels basically occupied and marginalized and suspected by central government. after the protests that started last year, the king dismissed three ministers and various other officials over a lack of progress in the development plan for the reef. Is this just lip service, or is the king trying to improve things?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, because it's so difficult to analyze this without any concrete, you know, tangible, empirical evidence or material. So there is a lot of, I wouldn't say lip service, but I would say like discourse. There is a lot of talk, there's a lot of rhetoric, there's a lot of, I don't know, maybe it is in some bizarre way, genuine disappointment and anger about how things have not been dealt with. But part of my own experience during the research I've been doing in the last 5 years has been to learn from the people I interview and who say, well, we don't believe this because this Mahzen, this system, is a combination of the national capitalist states, the intelligence services, in which the monarchy is deeply involved. So it cannot be, realistically speaking, that certain major changes or, you know, deliberate delays of certain improvements have occurred without anyone knowing. So no one really takes this serious. And some people even say, oh, these are crocodile tears, because they are genuinely not in tune with the people and have been shocked and surprised themselves by the response and by the anger. But more than anything, I think by the determination. I think that no one expected the determination of people would be so long standing. So I think that is why sometimes they need to play different cards at the same time. Hence also the symbolic politics of going there physically, doing big, you know, PR events like the King's speech and the large Arsh, the King's Day speech in that very locality. Symbols are important, right? If you say, oh, we don't like this region, we shun them, then you don't go anyway. But if you do go, you kind of want to say, we do like this region, we really respect you, and we want you to be part of our nation. At the same time, the people who've been asking for very normal, human, universal imams, who have done nothing against the law or criminal or what have you, should be released. And that has not been done, unfortunately.
One positive thing is it seems that these protests are spreading nationwide. There were demonstrations in Rabat, I believe in Casablanca, back in June. Berber, Amazigh, the correct term is Amazigh, but that means Berber. Berber groups, leftist opposition parties, human rights groups, as well as the banned Islamist movement Al-Hadr al-Ihsan, were present in these demonstrations. Let's start first with the Berber language issue, which is common to all three countries of the Maghreb, North Africa, Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. How is the Berber or Amazigh language and culture issue connected, if at all, to the current unrest? Is that something that exacerbates this feeling of marginalization? We haven't yet mentioned that this region is largely Berber-speaking, and that King Mohammed VI, when he came early on in his reign, had seemed to make some good moves, or at least some noises, in favor of Amazigh culture, at least on the surface. What is the state of Amazigh rights in Morocco, and how does that influence this movement? Does it make it worse? Tell us a little bit how that's playing out.
So there are different elements that push and pull these dynamics. The role of culture and the need to be acknowledged is, of course, one of them, and it's important regionally speaking. And of course, I mean, you know better than me, this has also been playing a role in Algeria and in other places. But I have to say that it is not unanimously equal in importance. The strength of the movement is that it's so diverse in its political demands and activists coming from different backgrounds, politically speaking. This Hirak, this movement that has been adopted by the name Hirak, has been made up.
Which in Arabic means means movement. It's the same word. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting how across the region protests have been named Hirak. I mean, there's a Hirak in Jordan, there's a Hirak in Lebanon, and we have a Hirak in Morocco. So, I mean, I've interviewed dozens of people, and not all of them have the same motivation. So for them, the issue of Amazigh culture is an emotional one, but not really what mobilized them politically. For others, it's really basic social economic issues, and they are not really invested in the sort of cultural aspects. And that is partly because this has been, well, to put it, you know, simply partly dealt with in a previous period when the previous king, Hassan II, who was sort of known as a much harsher, violent, dictatorial type of king, who really repressed people who were oppositional, whether they were leftist or culturally oppositional like Amazigh. But once he deceased and the new king came up, the Muhammad VI, there had to be changes, because with every new transformation, you need stability. One of the things that was on the agenda was the issue of the Amazigh language. So in the early 2000s, up until the mid-2000s, this was a very vibrant debate, and it actually resulted also in some changes. For instance, you could have television programs that were aired in Amazigh, different dialects of Amazigh. Obviously, there were some newspapers that were in Amazigh. It wasn't banned as it was before. So in a way, this was dealt with in a previous historical moment. But, I mean, one has to be careful with what it really means, because representation is important, but at the end of the day, it's about the content, right? So people would say, in retrospect, well, what we got was, for instance, yeah, another mouthpiece of the regime in another language. It wasn't really a major change in terms of our actual conditions and demands. So I think it's less prevalent as might seem from a distance for people who've been following the developments in Morocco and the Reef, who kind of want to make too quick the link between Amazigh culture and peoples and the protest movement. Okay. However, as I said, different motivations, different political agendas play a role. There are groups for whom this is a very important agenda, who really want to emphasize this cultural issue. But the regime also understood this. And so one of the compromises, one of the presents that was offered after the major uprising 2016 and 17 was to acknowledge Amazigh as an official, one of the official languages. I mean, you could say in an optimistic note that at least that is something that was a result of the protest, that it already achieved some results, and that it is a language that is not just, you know, here and there present on television or radio, but is also acknowledged within the constitution as an official language. But in essence, I don't think that is really what motivated people to continue up until this day.
Okay, so outside of Morocco, what has been the general attitude of major powers like France and the U.S. regarding the current unrest in the Reef?
There are interesting discussions about a geopolitical aspect, because obviously Morocco is an important ally of the West. It has been an ally against, well, what they particularly, I guess, the Americans and the Brits call anti-terrorism. It has been an important ally also in the sort of normalization and spreading of a neoliberal policy. So it has adopted neoliberal policies as its own sort of state economic rule, but also it is involved with all kinds of international, multinational dealings and wheelings. And so, as we know, this makes it less likely that many of the Western countries that are good friends and its allies to speak out very harshly or critically against the states. And interestingly, the discussion is now becoming more and more tense in the countries that also have a lot of Moroccans, you know, diasporic Moroccans. And you can think of the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, France, Spain, where people are actively involved in all kinds of solidarity campaigns and protests. And In the Netherlands, where I am at the moment, one of the political protests just in the recent days was organized against the Ministry of Justice, who had a meeting with the Moroccan Ministry of Justice, sort of a picket protest to demand the Dutch government to speak out against the injustice and to, you know, break its ties. But the result is really interesting because in this case, whereas the Netherlands is internationally known as progressive and really always defends and promotes international human rights, has said, well, we don't want to mingle in internal affairs. Mm. These are Moroccan internal affairs that we should not, it would be wrong to tell them what to do. Well, we've, of course, seen the opposite in many other cases, so nobody really takes this very serious. But if there is something we can learn from this, it is the fact that countries that need each other for all kinds of reasons, I mean, the Netherlands, it is because of the relationship with the country in order to talk about, deal with migration. Morocco is a kind of Fort Europe, you could say, outside of Europe. It's the border almost between the continent of Africa and Europe. So it is very important to keep them as friends in order to sort of, you know, do that thing that Trump loves so much, to build walls and fences and all that kind of stuff in order to prevent people migrating to Europe, but also in order to have a sort of stable, positive relationship with the country in order to talk about and deal with issues related to its own Dutch Moroccan citizens. So interests at the end of the day are very important and much more important than principles.
National interest. Traditionally, speaking of Trump, traditionally the bond between Morocco and the U.S. has been one of alliance and even fealty, apparently, yeah, in some cases. If I'm not mistaken, Moroccan Crown was the first foreign government to recognize, yeah, the U.S. when it became, yeah, independent.
Yeah.
How, yeah, is Trump's overt Islamophobia and outspoken contempt for the Palestinians, right, affecting the U.S.'s cozy relationship with the Mahzen?
Apart from Trump, which I think I would like to also know more about, what is interesting is, I don't know if we spoke the last time before the elections or after the
election. No, it was after the election. But I didn't ask you about Trump. Is there any lip service, at least, against some of the more extreme?
Why I'm asking you about the elections is because the Moroccans had invested enormously in its friendship and its money in Hillary Clinton. So they had a really close relationship with the Clintons. And I think no one expected Trump to win the election. So I think it's been a long period of readjustment, of confusion and adjusting to this new situation. And dealing with a person that is so vocally anti a lot of the things you actually represent yourself is entertaining, put it mildly. So I think this confusing rearrangement is still going on. The contradictions are there. So Trump would say something that would go against the Moroccan interests. But at the same time, in the background, a lot of the official military economic agreements and dealings are continuing, are ongoing, are untouched, really, by the presence of Trump. So I think with a lot of countries in the world, you have seen this, that things in a way have continued in terms of relationships with the United States, despite the aberration in the form of Trump. And I think this is also the case for Morocco.
I know that the population, at least, Moroccan people, very strongly sympathize with the Palestinians, and which is not the case here. You know, U.S. government is definitely, especially more than ever, pro-Israel, yeah, in ways that are both substantial and symbolic. Ever since the days of Hassan II and the early 60s, Morocco has always collaborated with Israel behind the scenes, helping move its very large Jewish population to immigrate to Israel, occupied Palestine. How is the relationship evolving under Trump? And I know I've already asked this, but this is especially emotional and tender point for the people of Morocco. Now that Trump and Adelson, Kushner are going in all the symbolic ways, not just substantial, but symbolically repudiating all efforts for peace and all window dressing.
No, I mean, historically, Moroccans have a very emotionally, politically close bond with Palestine. many, many people consider the Palestinian cause a national cause. They don't consider it a foreign cause that deserves some solidarity here and there, but they really consider it, they say, Qadiya Wataniya. They see it as their cause, that they are an extension of the Palestinians, are an extension of them, you know. So it's very deep and emotional. And when there are international demonstrations or because of an invasion by Israel, the protests in Morocco are usually enormous. The state kind of allows that because it also knows that this is very deep. And when it doesn't allow it, it causes confrontations and clashes. Sometimes it can't allow these expressions of solidarity and protest to be ongoing on the street because protests are always risky for any regime or state because it can always involve other demands and turn into something else, right? With Trump, I feel like the whole world, but also Morocco, has already been going through a period of almost numbness because of the extreme measures and right-wing turn in Israel and the fact that the international community has done little to nothing to defend and protect the Palestinians. It means that also people got kind of like numbed and used to the fact that they are left on their own. And they say that, huh? They say, Masakin, may God carry them. They are really left on their own. So with Trump, it kind of confirms all of that, right? That the whole debate about the move to the embassy to Jerusalem had caused the rage in Morocco, and the decision to then do it led to one of the biggest demonstrations in Morocco recently. So I think it is one of the sensitive issues for the Moroccan regimes. They can't really publicly support or condone Trump in any of its Palestine-related, how do you call it? You can't even say policy or expressions. It's kind of like flip-flop, crazy utterances. At the same time, the Moroccan people are not stupid. They have also knowledge of their own history, and they also know officially the role of Morocco in sort of assisting, you could say, now and then the Israeli state. It is a kind of known secret, a shameful one. People also talk about it with shame and regret. So people are also not naive. They also understand that their own regimes are part of an international network of regimes with different interests. And so, you know, they know that sometimes Morocco invites Israeli politicians or companies and what have you. So there are these sort of movements now in Morocco that are growing against normalization and in particular BDS. So there is a Morocco BDS campaign.
Boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Exactly. To put this on the agenda precisely because Morocco is a peculiar one when it comes to Palestine. But I think, again, so much is going on in Morocco, on Hirak and other things, that the main issues are not the ones they were 10, 15 years ago. After the Arab revolutions, there are so many other issues and cases that are sort of overshadowing or overwhelming the kind of political compass that we used to know. And so Palestine is also one of many issues and causes, albeit a very, very, on an emotional level, very special one that doesn't allow the regime to be too blunt and also maintains its privileged position as the council, the head of the council of Al-Quds. Morocco is officially the sort of symbolic head of the Jerusalem Al-Quds committee. And so they would, you know, emphasize this from time to time. They would organize conferences in order to sort of still, I wouldn't say capitalize, but I would say promote the idea that Morocco is also there for the Palestinians. But I think a lot of people consider that really lip service. And Palestinians actually told me so themselves in Jerusalem. They would tell me, oh, well, you're from Morocco. I'll tell your king we really don't need his free bread. Let him do other things.
This brings us back to what we were talking about earlier. We're dealing with a seriously neocolonial power at least the state level, not the popular level.
Yeah.
Well, Miriam, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have to go now. Thank you very much again, Miriam.
You're most welcome.
Take care. Bslema.
Take care. Bslema.
Miriam Awraq Asfar is a senior lecturer at the University of Westminster in London. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. What do kids in Gaza share with kids in the Bay Area? That's coming up next.
Régnant en maître sur un monde dompté. Pour être fière de toi quand t'allumes ta télé. Pour être fière de toi quand t'es au défilé. Parmésie d'une période qu'on peut vite, 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 vite oublier. Jusqu'au jour où il a bien fallu récolter les moissons d'un complexe de supériorité. Jusqu'au jour où il a bien fallu endurer la couleur des enfants de tes anciens valets. Jusqu'au jour où ça a commencé. Jusqu'au jour où le mistral s'est mis à souffler, secoue-toi, faut te réveiller. Mais qui t'es-toi? Qu'est-ce que tu crois? Montre-la-moi ta patte blanche. Et qui t'es-toi? Et qui t'es-toi? Qu'est-ce que tu fais là? Montre-le-moi, t'es habillé. Et qui t'es-toi? Détache-toi. Dis-le-moi ton identité. Puis un matin, la musique a tout fait changer. Les enfants dans ton dos se sont mis tôt. J'aime, 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 j'aime.
Last January, Heather Lamastrel, a Bay Area-based activist and a teacher, embarked on a life-changing project. She started a pen pal project connecting kids in her school with kids in Gaza. In August, she traveled to Gaza on a humanitarian mission, where she also visited with kids in her pen pal program.
This was my first time to the Middle East, actually. I bought a ticket not knowing if I was going to be granted access to Gaza, but I still felt like I needed to go just to see what life is like there. It started because I started a pen pal project with my students that I work with after school. And
when was that?
I reached out to an organization in January, got an answer right away that they would love to connect my students with children who are in cancer care in Bethlehem. And so in February, they wrote their first letters, and instantly, within a few days, I received letters of children in Gaza on the floor with pen and paper with letters and pictures of my students writing us back and smiling.
And the organization was the Palestine Children's Relief Fund,
yes,
which was founded in 1991 in the U.S. to address the medical needs of children in the Middle East. And they work all over the region, including Gaza.
Yes.
What this pen pal project intended to do?
For me, I felt like there's a need to connect people over a great divide. I work with children, so what better people to connect with other people but children who don't really understand the politics of all this? Because it's even hard for adults to understand the politics of the Middle East, the politics of Israel and with the United States backing them up and all the things that happened there, they don't really get it. As best as I've tried to lightly and delicately explain a divide, they don't get it. They don't really seem to care so much. They're just like happy to know that there are children that live through hard things that they can connect to. I think they feel very proud of that. Mm. They haven't used those words, but I can tell because they're always talking about their friends in Gaza. All the time they're talking about their friends in Gaza. I have a few students who say to me all the time that they want a kufiya. They want to wear it. They love my scarf. I wear it every day.
How old are these kids?
They're in fourth and fifth grade, so they're still kind of young.
So when this letter writing campaign, this friendship by mail, began, what was it that you wanted them to write, or what did they want to write, and how did they want to connect to the kids in Gaza? What kind of letters did they receive from their friends in Gaza?
Their letters are actually really simple. Their letters, you know, some of them didn't know what to write. Like, what do I tell somebody? I tell somebody everything about you that you have to introduce yourself. So they, of course, you know, said where they live, their age, what school they go to, their favorite subject, their favorite food, what they want to be when they grow up. And that's exactly what they got back. And from the very first letter, I could see so many similarities. I have a student who wants to be an architect, and there's a boy there who wants to be an architect. Mm-hmm. So you could see the differences.
So each kid here wrote to a specific kid over there,
well,
or it was just a letter that was just sent out and different kids received them?
I took a photo of each child, had them make like a little name placard and design it and draw it, make it colorful, and put a letter with each photo and just sent it. And then they specifically got, each one got a letter back from a different child. Mm-hmm. Most of the children were in Gaza, a few of them or in pediatric cancer care in the West Bank. The children in Gaza, though, I feel like we couldn't have connected with better pen pals. Those children in Gaza are working with social workers to have group therapy sessions to help with their PTSD because of where they live and obviously the constant violence and the bombings and stuff. So for them, I think it helps them to know that children that are so far away from them who have very different lives are thinking about them, that they have the experience to share with them, you know, what their dreams are and their hopes are for the future.
So when you went to Gaza, you said that you had to obtain entry permit.
Yes. You know, after my relationship with the PCRF had progressed to a certain point, I asked the president, Steve Sosabi, I said, look, I would really love to go there.
This is the Palestine Children's Relief Fund.
Yes, the president of that organization. I asked him, you know, how do I go about doing this? Who should I contact? What's the possibility? And he said to me, you know, ultimately, it's up to the government. It's not up to me. It's not up to anybody else. So we can see if we can apply for a permit and you can be there and work for us. And so that's what we did. So I, you know, filled out the application. They finished it and they sent it. And it took about 8 weeks to get approval. And I was really pleasantly surprised when I was told that I was going to be able to go.
Can you tell us a bit about what you did once you entered Gaza?
Yeah. So immediately, my first day there is Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, and the PCRF has raised millions of dollars to build a pediatric cancer unit onto the hospital. It just opened now. When I was there, it was about to be open. So when I was there, I got a tour from a representative of the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the lead architect, the lead engineer, who showed me around the hospital to see what it would look like when it would open. Pretty amazing. They make their own chemotherapy there. They have a beautiful nursery. So I was able to see where the children would be. And it was nice because the hospital itself, I said, wow, this is an old hospital. And they laughed and said, this is one of our best hospitals, but it just looks so antiquated until you walk into the pediatric cancer unit. So I was able to visit that facility. And then I visited three or four groups of children. I visited the pen pals of my students. And I also visited the Jabalia refugee camp, which is the largest refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. It's interesting because I asked them after talking with them for a while, I said, what would you like your pen pals to know about you? And the first thing they said, and they all said this, was that they live under constant siege. So they're constantly experiencing bombs, hearing bombs. And the second thing they wanted them to know is that they don't have any place for recreation. They don't have parks. They don't have play structures, soccer fields. They don't have swimming pools, athletic facilities. And then at that point, their social worker told me that they spend a lot of time at home. So when they're not at school, they're at home. So they don't have that ability. You know, where I work, the children have a playground to their access every day. You know, they get to us and the first thing they say, a lot of them, can we go outside? Can we go outside and play after being cooped up indoors all day at school? So they don't have that. And it's very clear to see when you're there that there aren't a lot of facilities for children. But as far as the people, I mean, Gaza itself is very dirty. You know, I think when you're living under a blockade and it creates a greater situation of poverty, the last thing you're thinking about is trash. And their water facilities have been bombed significantly through the years. So you see,
and the underground water aquifers are all polluted.
Yeah. And so they have actually what look like gas trucks, like tankers that deliver water. And you see them all the time on the road, people getting water. So that is something that is, I've never seen that anywhere in the world. So there's the water issue, there's the trash issue, the pollution issue, even the water off the coast. I asked my field escort when I was there, do you eat the fish? And he said, no, I won't eat the fish from here. But yet my translator said, oh, I eat it. It's no problem. I don't mind it. So there is that awareness, too, that the water is polluted. So even though you see lots of fishermen off the coast there, there are some people who just don't want to mess with that.
I spoke with someone in Gaza, and she told me that they have to use the city water to water their plants and vegetable gardens. You know, that's polluted water, so they don't know what kind of toxic chemicals are going to be in the fruits and vegetables that they will be eating.
Yeah. And, you know, and food is a problem for them, too, because their lives are completely controlled by an oppressive state, an oppressive government that has them under this blockade for, you know, over 10 years now. Before I was going, there was a bomb that was dropped four blocks from my hotel. Still, I wasn't scared. I was very excited to be there with them. And it was quiet. There was a negotiation of a ceasefire that they were working on. It didn't work. And 4 days after I left, there were bombings. And I was actually texting with my friends in Gaza, knowing that this was happening. I didn't bring it up because I just wanted to see how they were. And I will never forget being in a conversation with my friend. And he said, my house just shook. I think we're at war. And so this is kind of like what they live through all the time. But I have to say, they're so optimistic. When I was at the Jabalia refugee camp, when I was going, I was mentally preparing myself for being visibly shaken and for being upset. And from like the moment we got out of the car, we were actually laughing. And we laughed the entire time we were there, which I really didn't expect. And the energy from the children, I was followed by an army of children. From basically the second I got out of the car, people were staring at me, couldn't take their eyes off of me, slowly followed me. I got invited to do a home visit with someone and was sitting with them for a minute. And I saw that there were four children at the door, the open door, peeking in at me, really curious, like, who is this woman and why is she here? And then as I continued through the camp, they were all around me saying, hello, hello, how are you? And then I got approached by this really loud voice and says, oh, hi, how are you? Are you a doctor? What are you doing here? Because usually it's doctors and journalists that are there. And sometimes, you know, international workers with humanitarian organizations. And he was talking to me, oh, I used to live in London. I have a British passport, too. You know, do you want to come down to my house for tea? And it was like 92 degrees out. And of course, I said, yes, I would love to come down to your house for tea. And we sat in the alley outside the house. And I wish we could have spoken longer, but we were, you know, maybe 6 feet from each other. And it got to the point where it was hard to hear.
You were surrounded by kindness.
Yes. And the children, their energy was just so exciting. And they were talking as we were talking. But it was interesting to hear him say, I said, you know, do you think, are you optimistic that things will get better when Abbas retires? And he said, yes, absolutely. I think that the factions, you know, the government, the political factions in Gaza will shake hands and like brothers and will come to a sort of understanding as to how they can make things better. But and then I said, do you think the blockade will be lifted? Because for me, as someone whose heart really is there with those people, that's the biggest concern to me, is when is this blockade going to be lifted? That's the first thing that needs to happen. And he said, yes, I do think the blockade is going to be lifted, which I thought was really, really optimistic, because I don't see that happening, because they're constantly having breakdowns and negotiations with the Israeli government. But just their optimism, I mean, 40 bombs were dropped. It was like the second week in August, and, you know, caused a lot of destruction. And there was a cultural arts center there named after Edward Said, and it was flattened. Yeah. It was, it just turned into a big pile of rubble. And the people, what did they do in response to that? They brought instruments to the pile and they made music. They made an impromptu concert on top of this pile of rubble. So their optimism is just like amazing, amazing.
On the other hand, the wars on Gaza, the decade-old blockade on Gaza, has had devastating impacts on the mental and physical health of children. You visited a hospital in Gaza. What were some of the major physical and mental and emotional problems that kids in Gaza are suffering from and are carrying with them? What did you see?
Yeah, I visited the cancer unit, which was not open yet. So I didn't actually visit with patients when I was in Gaza. The children that I did visit with were the children that were in several facilities all over Gaza. The PCRF, I believe, has 6 offices in the Gaza Strip. So they have different organizations that they partner with, and then they have their own facilities where children...
Is it like a clinic?
Kind of. Yeah, yeah. And they come and work with other children in the group setting. So I couldn't see anything physical with these children. And I just, you know, learned from them about what their lives are like and what they see. So for me, I felt like when we're singing and dancing, I see happy children. But to hear, you know, children say, like, I live in the besieged city of Rafah, or I live in besieged Gaza, that's what they have in their head. Is that, hey, we have this war all the time. And I think that is extremely difficult for anybody, a child or an adult, to deal with.
Just according to Gaza Ministry of Health last Friday, this is part of Friday protests at the border with Israel, 7 Palestinian children died after being shot by Israeli soldiers, and a total of 252 people were injured, 154 of them by live fire. This is according to the Ministry of Health. So this is an ongoing issue for them, even the physical violence. It's not something that happens when there is a war. Why did you want to focus on this specific type of activism? And what do you want to do with all the information you've gathered, with being a witness, with hearing testimonies of people? What is it that you want to do with all of this information as an American?
That's a great question. For me, you know, I grew up in New York, and New York is extremely Zionist, extremely Zionist. And I remember when I came here, I felt like it's a lot more open, and people are very...
Here, meaning the Bay Area.
Yes, and people are more interested in having dialogue and conversation around things. And so I felt like very upset when I heard a few people in my community say to me in Berkeley, California, when I mentioned Palestine or Palestinian children or the UN report that said that Israel detains, arrests, and imprisons children at a higher rate than any other nation. When I would say that sometimes to people, I found them saying very close-minded things to me. And what I heard more often than other things was they teach their children to hate. And I would think to myself, but have you ever met their children? Do you know who they are? Do you know what's in their hearts? So for me, this was the opportunity to show that you don't know people if you haven't sat with them, you haven't spoken to them. So I felt like it was a good opportunity for children to know what's in the hearts of other children, and that was important to bridge a divide and to give a generation that doesn't know any politics. They're too young to know politics, so that they can see what's in the hearts of other people and maybe grow up not believing that kind of rhetoric that they might hear from people around them.
So you're thinking of expanding this PinPal project?
I would love to. I would love to expand this project. I know that the children really love it. They really, really, really love it. They talk to me about it more than I talk to them about it, which is really interesting for me. But also, you know, just having the opportunity to speak about it on the radio is also something that's important to me. Because when I would speak to adults about their political views or about their life, I would always ask them, do I have your permission to speak on this, to speak on your behalf and tell people what you're thinking and what you're feeling? And of course, they said, yes, absolutely, because they don't really have a voice. They really don't. And, you know, we'll see. It would be wonderful to make a documentary just to show how similar these children's lives are, but how different at the same time. But because what I saw was that for the most part, what's in their hearts is the same exact thing. They want to be safe. They want to grow up and be successful. They want to get a good education. And they want to do things to make their families proud. You know, and that's so universal. That's so universal, regardless of your political views, you know.
I just want us to end with you maybe talking about a couple of the letters that these kids, they have written to each other.
Yeah. Most of them were basically just stating facts to each other about their lives, what their families like, how many siblings they have. Some of them have an incredible amount of siblings in Gaza. And a few children, you know, one of my students, he's very emotional. He's a deep thinker. And he mentioned, you know, he loves to travel. And he says, you know, war's so bad and it's we have to stop wars in the world and we have to care for the animals and we have to care for the earth. And then he says, I hope one day I can meet you. And we will have fun and that we will get along. And it was interesting because the child that wrote him back did mention how bad the situation is there and said, you know, this is, it's really tough. The situation is very bad. They won't let us go to the sea, but maybe after we have peace, we can go to the sea. And I think they didn't contemplate that. They're like, they can't go to the beach. You know, they can't do these things. So a few children did mention that, that like life is tough here and we experience a lot of intense things. But overall, it just, you know, for them to hear them say what they want to be when they grow up.
Heather Lamastro is a Bay Area-based activist and a school teacher who started a pen pal project between kids in her school and kids in Gaza. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com, connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Ilan Pappe, The Idea of Israel. The Israeli historian spoke on September 14, 2018, at the City Club of Cleveland.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the City Club of Cleveland. I'm Robin Minter Smyers. I'm the president of the board of directors of the City Club. My role today is to introduce our speaker. But before I do so, I want to take a moment on behalf of our staff and my colleagues on the board of directors to acknowledge the controversy generated by our forum today. Since its founding in 1912, the City Club has provided a forum for public engagement here in our community, and we've hosted our share of speakers who've been controversial and about whom we've been criticized. That comes with the territory for a forum devoted to freedom of speech. That said, we did not anticipate that our speaker this week would generate the reaction that we have heard. While we have received some favorable feedback, respected community leaders, valued civic partners, and members of the community have raised serious objections. Some characterize his writings and speech as anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, and hate speech. We who are charged with the stewardship of the City Club take all of the feedback that we receive seriously. We pledge to use this as an opportunity to reflect on the role that this organization plays in the community and our own processes for carrying out that purpose. We believe that our work requires us to listen to others, including our critics, and learn from what we hear. This resolve to listen and learn does not lessen our commitment to our mission. Rather, it lives at its very core. Our speaker today is Dr. Ilan Pappe. He came to us through the Northeast Ohio Consortium for Middle East Studies, a collaborative of academics and scholars at Cleveland State University, Case Western Reserve University, and Kent State University, who invited Dr. Pappe to speak at their campuses. Dr. Pappe was born in Israel to German Jewish parents who fled Nazi persecution in the 1930s. His early life involved military service, undergraduate work in Jerusalem, and a PhD in history from Oxford University. The first portion of his professional career involved teaching Middle Eastern history and political science at Haifa University in Israel. In 2007, Dr. Pappe left Israel and took a post at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of numerous books on Israel and the Middle East. Ladies and gentlemen, members and friends of the City Club, Dr. Ilan Pappe.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to meet you all. And I would like to begin by one or two biographical notes, although I was very happy with this biographical resume as it was presented a minute ago. The most important part of my biography, I think, is that I was born in Israel in 1954. And as was mentioned, my parents escaped Nazi Germany in the 1930s, and both my mother and my father lost most of their relatives in the Holocaust. And this, for me, is a very formative part of my life. Much of what I do is informed by this family history. I grew up in Israel and the city of Haifa as quite a normal Israeli Jewish boy, which included serving in the army and unfortunately also participating in a war in 1973 on the Golan Heights. That led me in the 1980s to begin a career that combined together scholarship with activism. And the main impulse was realization, as someone who wanted to be a professional historian, that there are hidden chapters in the history of my country that were either wiped out, fabricated, distorted, but in any case were not available for me as a young man, that had an impact on the reality in my own lifetime. And when slowly the pieces of the puzzle unfolded, what emerged was a picture that made me feel that I cannot be indifferent for what had been done in my country in the past and is being executed in the present. I remembered that both my father and uncle used to tell me that although they were very afraid of the Nazi thugs in Germany in the 1930s, the people they really were angry with were those who could do something and didn't do anything. And I didn't want to be such a person. I had a privileged position as an academic in Israel, and I had a privileged position as a Jewish citizen of Israel. And I thought that privilege is a duty to do all I can for those people that I felt were oppressed, colonized, mistreated for over 70 to 100 years in my own country, by my own state. And I needed the connection between my scholarly research and my activism to work well together. And one of the questions that bothered me both as a scholar and as an activist, and is the title of this morning's talk, is what I call the idea of Israel. What I meant by the idea of Israel is that there is a conundrum for me as an Israeli Jew, and for many Israelis, I think. How come, given with everything that is happening in the world, there is still a question mark about the legitimacy of the Jewish state? How come, with all the atrocities and the ruthless behavior of both regimes and oppositions in the Arab world and in the Middle East, yet a lot of people around the world feel that the most important example of injustice is that of Palestine? And I wanted to understand it. I wanted to understand the conundrum of a country or a state which, on the face of it, is very strong. It has the strongest military presence in the region, the strongest army in the Middle East, the fourth or the fifth strongest army in the world. According to a lot of sources, it possesses 250 nuclear weapons. It is a high-tech nation. It has, according to its own image, a very vibrant multicultural environment. It has the city of Tel Aviv, which is a safe haven for gay culture, among other things. And yet, with all that security and power, its people feel insecure. They are questioned about their legitimacy in the world. And whatever they do to fight it, they meet conscientious people. Some of them used to be great supporters of Israel who tell them, yes, we know about the high-tech nation. Yes, we know about Tel Aviv. But we know about other things as well. And these other things question your achievements. These other things lead us to ask, who are you? What are you doing? And what is your vision for the future? And I think in order to understand this conundrum, you have to go back to history. What went wrong? And what led to such a large number of people who are honest, who are conscientious, who are educated, to say to the Israelis, sorry, we cannot support you anymore. We have a problem with who you are and what you are doing, whether we are Jewish, Muslims, Christians, or Buddhists. And in this country, slowly the number of people who support Israel is decreasing, and you are left with Christian Zionist and Jewish communities being the only pillar on which the support for Israel relies on. The idea of Israel is the idea that the Jews of the world have the right to create in the land of Palestine their homeland and to gather all the Jews around the world to be part of a new Jewish nation state where the Jewish right for self-determination would be exercised, where Jews would feel safe from anti-Semitism and persecution, and where they could exercise their culture, tradition, and identity. What is interesting about this idea that originally it was not a Jewish idea. It's a Christian evangelical idea. Back in the 17th century, the idea of Israel was conceived in Europe, where evangelical priests and thinkers had the notion that you can have a kind of a double bill if you think of sending the Jews to Palestine. It's a double bill because on the one hand you can get rid of the Jews. These were anti-Semitic evangelical Christians. They wanted to get rid of the Jews of Europe. So one part of the bill is you send them to Palestine. The other one was theological. If the Jews return to Palestine, this may precipitate the second coming of the Messiah and the resurrection of the dead and the conversion of the Jews to Christianity or their shish kebabbing in hell if they refuse. Benjamin Netanyahu should be told about it because his greatest friends in this country are Christian Zionists who have this image of barbecuing Jews in hell if they will not convert to Christianity on doomsday. This idea became a far more serious project when Jewish thinkers and activists in Central and East Europe adopted it in the late 19th century. Because they adopted the idea of the return to Palestine not because of Christian evangelical views and not because they wanted the Jews to leave Europe. Actually, most of the Jews wanted very much to stay in Europe, but the Europeans did not allow them to stay in Europe. So the idea was born out of two impulses. The wish to be safe, and it was not safe to be a Jew in late 19th century Central and Eastern Europe, and the wish to redefine Judaism as a national movement. Everyone in Europe in the late 19th century were redefining themselves. And nationalism was the most attractive way of redefining yourself as a modern person. And the Jews had a lot of objective features in their faith and religion that lended themselves to a redefinition of Judaism, not just as a religion, but also as a national identity. So the idea of Israel became a Jewish idea, not just a Christian idea. And Jewish activists began to work for the idea of the return of the Jews to Palestine as a project of salvation, but also as a project of redemption. The problem was with the project of redemption, not with the idea that the Jewish thinkers who thought themselves as Zionists believed that they were the descendants of the Jews who were expelled by the Romans 2,000 years before. That was not the issue. Whether they were right or not is not very important. But they felt that they were the descendants of the Jews who lived during what the Jews believed was the Second Temple, and that that temple was destroyed by the Romans at the time of Christ, and that they were expelled, and they were actually were looking to coming back home after 2,000 years of exile. What the problem with the redemption was not the validity of this claim. The problem with the redemption was that someone else was living in Palestine, the Palestinians. So what do you do if you want to return to a safe place, if you want to redefine yourself as a modern nation, if you want to redeem what you think is your ancient homeland and someone else's lives in your homeland. Well, you know what people did here when they found someone else living. You genocided the natives of America, as did the Australians, as did the people of New Zealand, as did, to a certain extent, the people who came from Europe to certain parts of Africa. We call that movement of Europeans who flee Europe because they are persecuted and are looking for a safe new haven outside of Europe, we call that movement settler colonialism. People want to replace the indigenous population so that they can build themselves a safe haven, a nation state, instead of the people who lived there, sometimes for centuries, sometimes for millennia. So the problem with the idea of Israel began when the wish to find for the Jews a safe haven and to allow them to redeem an ancient homeland was encountered with the reality on the ground that someone else was already living there. And like so many other settler colonial movements, the idea of the new state could not include the indigenous native population. The early Zionist painters drew beautiful pictures of Palestine in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. But if you look closely at these paintings, and you know the landscape, you can see that the villages do not appear on the hills, that the Arab neighborhoods do not appear in the cities, that the Palestinians are absent from the pictures and from the early 20th century from the photographs. And they also don't appear in the poems, and they don't appear in the fiction, and they don't appear in the early films. And that was ominous, but the Palestinians did not understand it. Because if someone doesn't write about you, if someone doesn't include you in the painting, there is a likelihood that when they would have the power, they would also take you out of the country. And the main problem with the idea of Israel later on was that part of the idea of creating a Jewish nation state was a wish to have a democratic state, because these were European Jews who really subscribed to what was good in Europe, whether it was liberalism, socialism, democracy, human rights, or civil rights. And they understood from very early on that if you want to have a Jewish democracy, you need to deal with the demography. How can you have the first election in a newly founded Jewish state if the Jews are not the majority? What would happen? Would the Palestinians vote for the idea of a Jewish nation homeland? Probably not. And from the 1930s onwards, the idea of Israel was based on either a wish or an active plan to get rid of the Palestinians. And the historical opportunity arrived in 1947, 1948, when the British, who ruled Palestine for 30 years, decided they had enough of the place, referred the question of Palestine to the United Nations, and allowed the Zionist movement to decide by itself how to sustain the idea of Israel with this conundrum. The wish to build a Jewish democracy on the one hand, and a demographic reality where the Jews are a minority. In 1948, the Jews were one-third of the population of Palestine, and most of them came just 3 years earlier. This is why the Palestinians did not accept the United Nations idea that Palestine should be divided between the settlers, who should have more than half of the country, and the natives. No national liberation movement at that time agreed to give half of the country to a movement that they deemed as a settler movement or as a colonialist movement. So this was not a solution. And the result was that neighboring Arab states who were pushed to act in Palestine because the Zionist movement began already in the last days of the mandate to expel the Palestinians from Palestine. Arab states who didn't want to do much about Palestine were pushed by their own public opinion to send contingents into Palestine on the day that the British left Palestine, on the 15th of May 1948, the day of the creation of the State of Israel. But when they came too late. Half of the Palestinians that became refugees were already in refugee camps when the first Arab soldier entered Palestine on the 15th of May 1948. In my hometown, Haifa, out of 75,000 Palestinians, only 3,000 were left on the 21st of April 1948. Similar fate awaited the people of Jaffa, Akka, Beisan. 11 towns in Palestine were depopulated. 500 villages out of 1,000 were destroyed and wiped out. And on the ruins, Israel planted forests with European pine trees or built Jewish settlements, sometimes carrying the same name as the Arab village name, in order to claim that this is not an occupation but a redemption. So Safuria became Tzipori, Lubia became Lavi, Ma'an became Ma'an. This tragedy, this catastrophe, this act of ethnic cleansing of the indigenous native people of Palestine was watched closely by the world. The New York Times had correspondents who reported quite accurately what happened on the ground. The Red Cross had emissaries that told the headquarters in Geneva of how Palestinian men, women, and children are being deported from their homeland and from their places where they lived for 800 years. And yet, the world was quite passive for various reasons. First of all, tragedies of that kind occurred 3 years before all over the world at the time of the Second World War. A similar tragedy occurred also in India when the British left it in the summer of 1947. And moreover, the international community felt it could not condemn a movement, a political movement that claimed to represent the Jewish victims of the Holocaust by perpetrating crimes against the indigenous population. It was too sensitive. So the Palestinians were pushed out of their country, lost their homes, lost their lands, lost their properties, and were not allowed to return, while the world was watching and thinking it will somehow resolve itself. Somehow this problem would be forgotten. The problem that Europe was responsible more than anyone else for the creation. First, by not allowing the Jews to stay in Europe, and secondly, by supporting the colonization of Palestine. The idea of Israel remained quite steadfast and unquestioned until the 1980s. Of course, Palestinian historians, Palestinian activists, Palestinian poets and writers were trying to say to the world, look, we are victims of a crime. We are fighting a just war of liberation. But they were, as you know, branded as terrorists, as people who are primitive, as people who have no right to do what they were doing and were condemned. But something happened in the 1980s and the 1990s, of which I write in my book, The Idea of Israel. Quite a few Israeli historians, poets, playwrights went through the same journey as I did. They started looking at the past through more critical eyes. And they discovered these hidden chapters that made them feel obliged, as I felt obliged, to do something for the Palestinian cause as Israeli Jewish citizens. And in the 1990s, it was quite exciting to be in Israel, when all these young Israeli men and women, Jewish Israeli men and women, were learning or relearning the history of their country, understanding for the first time the Palestinian perspective, and wanting, as I wanted, to do everything they can do to rectify this historical injustice. But for the rest of the Israeli Jewish society, this was too much. And in 2000 came the reaction, which I call in the book the Neo-Zionist reaction. This was an attempt from above to silence this internal criticism. This was a way of looking at this criticism as an act of treason. I cannot count or remember the numbers of time that I was called in my own university a traitor, just because I taught the events of 1948 as an act of ethnic cleansing, just because I was fighting for civil and human rights for the Palestinians, wherever they were, and just because I said that the right of return of the Palestinian refugees is a sacred right on which I'm willing to fight for all my life. So it became an act of treason to tell the truth about the history of Palestine. And this is why, and with this I will conclude, there is a very big clock here that does not allow you to deviate. This is why, since 2005, in this country, something quite amazing is happening. And this thing is called BIG. I don't know if you know what BIG is. BIG is brand, the Brand Israeli Group. The Brand Israeli Group. In 2005, Benjamin Netanyahu allocated millions of dollars to try and rebrand Israel as a positive country because of all the criticism that came out of the solidarity with the Palestinian people and their struggle. And the first stage of BIG was to talk about the achievements of Israel and to avoid the moral debate about Israel's behavior. And this didn't work. People wanted to talk about the moral behavior, especially young people who have seen what's going on in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, in the Galilee, in the Nakba, in the refugee camps. So in 2010, BIG moved to another strategy. And this was to blame anyone who even slightly criticized Israel as an anti-Semite. They called it the new anti-Semitism. This is a fabrication of reality. The vast majority of the most critical voices against Israel in this country are Jews. So definitely they cannot be anti-Semitic. They may be self-hating Jews, as I am. I went to the doctor to find a medicine for a self-hating person, so I'm still suffering from the disease. And for some reason, people in Israel think that it will work. This will not work until we restitute the Palestinian rights, until we give them back their human and civil rights and allow them to conduct normal life everywhere in historical Palestine and coming back to the land of Palestine. There will be no peace, no reconciliation, and unfortunately, the conflict would rage on. Thank you very much.
You heard the Israeli historian, Professor Ilan Pappé. Pappé is director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter, UK. He was recorded by IdeaStream, Cleveland's nonprofit public media company, at the City Club of Cleveland on September 14, 2018. Find the link to the video on tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Canada is being colonized either by Britain or by the U.S., and that ignores or completely downplays the power that Canada has internationally, and how Canadian corporations are major international banking, mining, engineering, others are major international players, and not they're not at the periphery of global capitalism. They're really at the center of global capitalism, and the whole left nationalist perspective of Canada being colonized by the U.S. and colonized by Britain really obscures the immense power that Canadian corporations have in the world.
That's the voice of author and activist Yves Engler. In this week's show, we speak to Yves regarding his latest book, Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. So stay tuned.
I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. This morning, we are very privileged to have our very own Yves Engler. He has been dubbed Canada's version of Noam Chomsky, and he is based in Vancouver with his latest book, Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Thank you for joining us, Yves.
Thanks for having me.
When we think about Canada, most people think of a country that is committed to peacemaking, a country that is fairly progressive, very multicultural. What inspired you to write this book, and what is the missing story that we're not telling?
I mean, as I've detailed in previous books, Canadian foreign policy is really structured around advancing empire, historically British, today American, and advancing Canadian corporate interests abroad. So you can span the globe and you find example after example that that shows how Canada has been engaged in wars that are unjust, that the Canadian policy has been about Canadian diplomats supporting different Canadian corporations in spite of what those corporations are doing in different places in the world. And this book is really, it's looking at part of answering the why Canadians are so confused about Canada's role in the world, why Canadians think that this country is a force for good, when in fact the evidence overwhelmingly suggests that Canadian foreign policy is about advancing empire, about advancing corporate interests. And specifically, this book looks at how the left institutions, dominant left institutions, have contributed to confusing Canadians about this country's foreign policy, to going along with a dominant narrative about this idea of Canada as being a benevolent international actor. And it looks at all kinds of, it looks at the NDP's foreign policy, looks at labor unions' foreign policy, looks at some left institutions and left commentators, how much they concede to the dominant narrative of Canadian foreign policy. So it's partly a sort of a critical examination of the left's foreign policy.
You know, when we think about Canada, most people would prefer to not think of a country that is based on colonial practices and structures, but when we think about colonialism, this idea that the colony, right, this place that was taken by force, not with permission, the land has been occupied, and the original people are still here, yet we carry on as if that is something of the past, some distant past that we briefly remember, and then we move on to the new version of Canada. It's really easy to see how colonialism, can be understood. And yet, empire, when we think about imperial Canada, how do you make the distinction? Because for most people, this is the colony. As my in-laws used to say, how are things in the colonies? They still think of Canada as simply a colony of the UK. And most Canadians would even negate that we have a colonial history. So I think it's important that we not only understand the role of colonialism in modern terms in the era of neoliberalism, but also what we mean by empire, by this imperial power that we call Canada.
You exactly correct in that one part of better understanding Canadian foreign policy is to understand that to a large extent what Canada was, talking at the time of Confederation, it was the extension of British power in this part of the world. It was about extending British power to Asia, and that people who refer to Canada as a colony of Britain are obscuring the relationship of the power relationship. So, you know, Canadians or the British or the French who settled Canada weren't dispossessed of their land like the Kikuyu were dispossessed of their land in Kenya. They dispossessed First Nations, of course, right? So Canada was, you know, was part of the extending the British colonial project, imperial project. Now, in terms of talking about Canadian imperialism today, I mean, I think it's important to talk about to refer to it as imperialism. I don't think it's just the extension of, you know, 100 or multiple hundreds of years of colonial British colonial project. There are particulars to Canadian imperialism. So, for instance, the huge power of the Canadian-based mining sector throughout Africa, throughout Latin America, I think is somewhat of a distinctly Canadian imperialist endeavor, right? Where half the world's mining companies are based in Canada and listed on Canadian stock exchanges, and they're listed and based in Canada for a whole series of reasons, partly because Canadian stock exchanges are very permissive in terms of what they accept in terms of disclosures, partly because the Canadian government provides so much support through aid money, through diplomatic support, through even, you know, militarily to the mining sector globally. So I would consider that somewhat of a, obviously not unique to Canada, but a major Canadian contribution to world imperialism. The mining sector would be a sort of major Canadian contribution. So I think it's important to look at, you know, there's many facets to imperialism. Obviously, Canada's, you know, military deployments ongoing right now is a time when we're, you know, not really supposed to be at war, but you have Canadian military deployments in Ukraine, in Latvia, around Korea, in Iraq. You have Canadian military deployments, you have Canadian naval vessels, you know, patrolling in the Middle East constantly. So this is, again, this is a time of, you know, not a time when Canada's not supposed to be at war, yet we have this aggressive international military footprint, which I think is also an element of imperialism, obviously an element of Canadian imperialism that's closely tied to the U.S. version. There are many different facets to Canadian imperialism.
When I think about the difference for me between colonial and empire making is the way in which a colony is, you know, destructive, displaces people. And yet there are, like most of us in Latin America, there's still mature cultures that continue to coexist. Whereas I think of empire as a way of not only destroying, but also eliminating the connections that people may have. So in this case, when we think about how we see the land, how we see ourselves and our connection to the land, this idea of capitalism as the only way of organizing our social relations, this idea of neoliberalism, you know, displacing any kind of social structure that supports and upholds people's ideas of healthcare, of well-being, of education. All of those things are being drawn out by the idea of the new empire, which most people now accept as the U.S., you know, one of the imperial powers, be it by the mighty of their military force or by the mighty of their economic warfare, whether it be sanctions or literally invasions, as you just described. In your book, you talk about how the left in many ways is now complicit in this role. Can we talk a little bit about what our role ought to be if we are people who envision a society that is committed to justice, to democratic processes, to not only acknowledging but also correcting and some restitution for the harms that have been committed in the past in our name?
I mean, I think it's about people being active, getting mobilized, joining different social movements that are challenging some of these issues. So for instance, right now you have Canada heavily involved in efforts to destabilize and weaken the government in Venezuela, and there is Venezuela solidarity groups that operating mostly fairly small across the country. It's about, you know, getting involved in those initiatives and challenging Canadian decision makers who are pursuing policies that, you know, contravene the UN Charter, contravene, you know, sanctions policies that are designed to undercut Venezuela's economy and designed to, you know, punish the government, try to overthrow the government. And it's about people joining those groups, like the different Venezuela solidarity groups that exist, that joining the, you know, different anti-war organizations that are mobilizing. I mean, obviously, on with regards to domestic colonialism, joining, you know, different indigenous-led struggles, be it against pipelines, against just for indigenous sovereignty. I mean, I don't think there's any real answer except that people should, if people are troubled by different political issues, that people should do what they can to change those issues and to know that the official political sphere is one area to try to change stuff, but most of long-term transformation takes place by people who are not focused on their own power, but focused on doing what's right and mobilizing people to change the power structures in society to bring about you know, more just future. Often with very limited or no direct benefit to themselves in the you know, short or medium term, but because this is what's right, and you know, as long histories of people making society better by doing that, and that's, I think, the main advice that people should take. Certainly with regards to Canadian foreign policy, that's the central way is you know, getting involved in different groups, challenging these issues, building the alternative media that's not just beholden to power and whatnot.
In some ways, I agree with you that there's such an importance to be honest and point out, you know, when we tend to maybe be overly complacent, right, to the structures that create not only domination, but that are continuing to promote plundering of the earth in a moment when we know that if we continue this course, we will self-destruct. It's not that the earth will continue to be, but we as human beings may not be able to stay here. So it, not only is creating justice and this ideal of a society with justice a more beneficial path to take, but also it's a more, you know, nourishing and empowering way of being. What are your practices on a day-to-day basis, not only to keep yourself inspired and motivated, but also to continually, you know, question your beliefs? How am I positioning myself within the struggle? How am I participating in, you know, uplifting or being an obstacle to a process of emancipation, which is really what we ought to be on?
Yeah. I mean, I engage in you know, self-reflection on some of those questions, and I think that it's important to do so. I think that there can be sometimes where that can be it can be a little bit too inward looking, getting too over focused in that direction. I think that there's you know, there's a place for almost everybody that, you know, our issues of today are with regards to environmental issues and social injustice issues are so massive that we really need everyone involved in the process. And yeah, I don't know that I think that it's obviously important to be involved and, you know, be self-reflective and to think about those questions. But I think that there can be, there's so much work to be done, and there's so many different ways in which to engage in that work. It's important to have activist cultures that focus really on people, giving people a place to engage and letting people figure stuff out on their own a little bit. And there's obviously lots of trial and error, and people make lots of mistakes. It's important to be self-reflexive, but it's I think there's a lot of work at hand. Doing that work can be a little diverted from overemphasis on individuals sort of making sure that everything they've done is perfect in the process, because it never will be, of course.
When I think about your books, they often bring us to a place of self-reflection, and I didn't mean as an inward reflection, but rather as a co-creative reflection. You know, how we as human beings co-create the society we live in, and as a settler, as a person who is in a way complicit, right, in the continuation of Canada as an empire. If we are not organized, right, we may find ourselves feeling alone and powerless. All of those, to me, are simply an invitation to realize that we are only stronger as a community, as, you know, as a circle of people who are seeing a new vision through, right? A vision of justice, of reparation, a vision of connection, not just to one another, but also to the earth. And when I read your books, I am aware of all the places my presence is needed, all the places, you know, my voice can contribute, and, you know, we can be part of something greater. You have several concerns in your book. Can you speak to some of the key issues that you are outlining in your book?
I look at the history of the NDP and the CCF conceding on Canadian foreign policy. Look at oftentimes the NDP has supported Canadian militarism. So, for instance, in Libya in 2011, the NDP voted in the House of Commons twice to support the NATO bombing of Libya, even though that was clearly being done in violation of the UN Resolution 1973. I look at just the general history of militarism within the NDP and historically the CCF. The NDP and CCF, you know, supported the creation of NATO, supported Korean War, has a whole history of ignoring Canadian corporate power in the hemisphere, Canadian banking dominance in the Caribbean, and avoiding challenging that or even really talking about that. So yeah, the book also looks at labor unions and how labor unions have conceded on Canadian foreign policy and have for decades were very much aggressive supporters of Canadian imperialism. That's somewhat lessened today with regards to labor movement. Now unions are now not usually supportive of you know the wars that Canada is part of. Unlike the NDP, which tends to still be a kind of active supporter, labor unions, even progressive labor unions, are usually just both silent on these issues, which of course allows the corporate world, allows the Canadian state to pursue those, you know, pro-imperial policies. The book also has a section on left institutions, think tanks, and commentators, and how people like Stephen Lewis, and Linda McQuaig, and other Walter Dorn, and others have really conceded to the dominant narrative of Canadian foreign policy, and oftentimes even sort of whitewash the history of Canadian foreign policy crimes. And then it has a section looking at nationalism or nationalisms and sort of the why left institution and commentators have really accepted much of dominant Canadian foreign policy. An important part is left nationalism and the whole idea that's a really important part of Canadian nationalism of Canada as being this benevolent international actor. And part of the sort of left nationalist why there's confusion about Canadian foreign policy is because there's so much focus on Canada as being colonized either by Britain or by the U.S. And that ignores or completely downplays the power that Canada has internationally, and how Canadian corporations are major international banking, mining, engineering, others are major international players, and they're not at the periphery of global capitalism. They're really at the center of global capitalism, and the whole left nationalist perspective of Canada being colonized by the U.S., colonized by Britain, really obscures the immense power that Canadian corporations have in the world.
Understanding our positional power as a nation, if we are to see each other as a collective nation, what advice would you offer to people wanting to create change in our foreign policy?
I think the main thing is people need to get engaged with the groups that are already active on these issues, right? There are small peace groups, there are small mining and justice solidarity groups, there are small Palestine solidarity organizations. Join those groups, create new ones. One thing I put forward in the book is the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute, which is already in its initial phase online. People can check it out at foreignpolicy.ca. And it's basically initially just a repository of critical information on Canadian foreign policy, but with time, hopefully built into a more substantive left-wing foreign policy think tank that really brings together all the different critical voices on Canadian foreign policy, and also produces produces materials about Canadian foreign policy, and then maybe eventually even setting up chapters across the country, but mostly at initial phase, really a place to bring together criticisms or challenges of Canadian foreign policy, all the different facets, right? Because there's groups working on Palestine, there's groups working on mining, there's groups working against war, but oftentimes it's not part of a whole sort of more general critique of Canadian foreign policy. And I think there's some value in bringing that together. So people can check that out, get on the foreignpolicy.ca, can sign up for the newsletter. But mainly it's about getting engaged with the local groups that are fighting on these different issues.
Yves Singler will be presenting his books in Vancouver. You're visiting Vancouver with your latest book, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Tell our audience how they can connect with you while you're visiting.
Yes, yeah, so I'm doing a few events in the Vancouver and a couple at UBC and one at SFU, the main one being at SFU on October 30th. People can get the details at 6 p.m. at SFU at the Harbor Center downtown. People can find the details on my site, evengler.com, Y-V-E-S-E-N-G-L-E-R. And have the list of the different events I'm doing in the Vancouver area.
Thank you so much for being with us. What keeps you inspired that not only are we able to transform society, but also create a society with more justice for all?
I think that the scope of injustice out there, it makes me feel that there's a need to stay engaged and people resisting these different injustices in infinitely more difficult situations than I'm in. So, some days if you get tired and you're not sure if it's worth it, that's infinitely less of an obstacle than somebody who's languishing in jail or who's having difficulty finding food to put on the table or whatnot. I think that there's a long part of why the positives we have in our society today, part of why the freedoms that exist today is because of, people before us who have spent the time and done the work to advance those freedoms. And I take a lot of inspiration from those struggles and others who are struggling in more difficult circumstances than I.
Thank you so much for being with us today and good luck on your travels.
Thank you, Sylvia.
That was Yves Engler and his latest book, is Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada.
I'm going
to
finish the show with a song by Buffy St. Marie called Piney Wood Hills. Talk to you next time.
I'm a rambler and a rover and a wanderer, it seems. I've traveled all over chasing after my dreams. But a dream should come true and a heart should be filled and a life should be lived in the piney wood hills. I'll return to the woodlands, I'll return to the snow, I'll return to the hills and the valley below. I'll return like a poor man or a king if God wills, but I'm on my way home to the piney wood hills. I was raised on a song there. I done right, I done wrong there. And it's true, I belong there. And it's true, it's my home. From ocean to ocean, I've rambled and turn to my piney wood home. Maybe someday I'll find someone who will love as I love my piney wood hills. I was raised on there, and I done right, I done wrong there. And it's true, I belong there. And it's true, it's my home. And I'll return to the woodlands, I'll return to the snow, I'll return to hills and valley below. I'll return like a poor man or a king if God wills, but I'm on my way home to the piney wood hills.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.